Last night I dreamed I held your face in my hands and I watched your skin melt and explode. I never asked to be the human bomb. I don't want to be the human bomb. I'm the living storm after the calm. I'm the human bomb. Shrink said he thinks that every superpower reflects some deep-seated fear or need. And if you're obsessed with bats, I could see how you'd end up like that. You might wish to fly or for super speed. But I never asked to be the human bomb. I don't want to be the human bomb. Some super science accident gone all wrong. I'm the human bomb. And all I feel is despair. I want to take off my helmet, this suit, and these protective gloves and just breathe the air. I want to feel you there. I'm sorry, but I want to touch you. Last night I dreamed I held your face in my hands and sparks flew, but nothing happened. I never asked to be the human bomb. I don't want to be the human bomb. I am death, I am destruction.
Hello.
Hey, what was going on? You were on mute or something.
I was muted.
Ah.
I went to the Bill Bulmer School of Podcasting.
You were trained by the best.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hola, mi amigo. ¿Cómo está?
Bien.
Ah, good.
I don't know how to...
Bien, bien.
I don't know how to say back at you.
Yeah, not sure. Indeed. Welcome to Geek Brunch Retrocast.
Yes. What
this
number?
Is, 48.
Ah.
I believe.
I lost track.
Yeah. I think it's 48 because I know we're closing in on
50.
That's. I don't think I've ever done 50 of anything. Yep, 48.
Not even 50 push-ups.
Yeah,
50 probably. Sit-ups.
I don't know if maybe I was forced to at some point. I'm lucky that I have the genes that I do because I'm not. I've never had very good exercise habits.
Ah,
I'm trying to get better.
So you called me yesterday and left, or actually Facebook chatted. I never seen that before. But what was that? Was that Dracula or what?
I think that's what I was going for, yeah. I sent a, you can send a voice message via Facebook chat, apparently.
Yeah.
And
virgins!
I couldn't think of what I was supposed to be saying, but I was trying to talk like Blood for Dracula.
Yeah, that's. I didn't get that at first.
No, I'm not surprised.
Especially the first part, because I could. Me and Barb were on the deck. I was reading comics, and Barb was reading a novel, and I got the message, and I played it. And she's like, "What is he saying?"
She probably followed it.
I heard the first part, but then I was like, "Where's the virgins?"
No, I think I just trailed off into growling.
Yeah, it sounded like ah.
Then it occurred to me what the correct phrase was. The
The virgins.
virgins. But yeah, I was a little silly yesterday afternoon. So we had went out to brunch, and I had Bloody Mary, and then we went around to some breweries. So I went to the Bill Bomer School of Podcasting, but I went to the Keith Knudsen School of Saturdays.
Saturdays and Wednesdays for some reason. I watch him on Wednesdays, and it's either Wednesday or Tuesday on Twitter, and he just goes like ballistic with the beers. So that's an odd day to do it.
Yeah, that is. I pretty much stick to the weekend for the most part.
All right.
But yeah, so did you end up getting a chance to watch Buck Rogers or?
I did. I'm
Okay,
ready.
cool.
I'm
Yeah,
ready to
that's.
talk about some Buck Rogers.
Yeah, it's been a while, and it's well, it was an interesting episode.
I'll just say this up front. The biggest part that distracted me, like it just, I could, my mind couldn't wrap itself around, was Twiggy's voice. That was horrible. And I could see if it started off like that. But because of what Mel Blanc did, it was embedded in my mind always what Twiggy would sound like, and he didn't even sound close anymore. Didn't even seem like the same character.
No, it wasn't like they found somebody similar. And I mean, long-time listeners of the show would know this, but just in case, I'll say that we're starting season two, which is a shorter season and introduces a lot of changes. I guess that they got a new producer, and that's where some of it comes from. Some of the changes comes from that, but yeah, like you said, Mel Blanc was the voice of Twiggy, and I don't know if you noticed, but he actually comes back later this season.
That's even worse.
Yeah, with no explanation.
I'll finally get used to the other guy's voice. And this episode was really interesting. There didn't seem to be a bridge of explanation between the first season and the second season. Like there didn't seem a bridge. The only thing that I could see in my mind is if you watch the first season, you would say, okay, these guys are now like the Enterprise, and they're Wilma and Buck and Twiggy, and the rest of the cast is totally different. They're on this ship called the Searcher, right? And they just go to explore the universe, and it turns into like a more closer to Star Trek than it did have the feel of the original Buck Rogers. Plus it. The humor was like totally different. At least I felt it was. It wasn't as campy, and I like that camp, you know? It tried to have some humorous moments, but it didn't have that campy moment, and I thought it lost some of its flair.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that it's almost awkwardly seeming to go after the whole Star Trek feel. And yeah, that was one thing I read and also noticed and felt was true was the difference in humor and just the lack thereof too. There was definitely less of it. And Buck, I mean, when you first see Buck in the episode, he's hitting on a woman, but other than that, he definitely seemed a lot more serious. I thought like his portrayal was of the character was different. And I also read that I don't know if we'll see, I feel like we saw some of this, but we'll see, maybe see more of it throughout the season. But they also intentionally made Wilma more feminine and less, like less of a commanding officer.
Yeah, they turn like instead of wearing her normal like flight suit, she was either in the flight suit or the blue suit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was like fully clothed. Now she's like in a mini skirt dress, you know?
Yeah, her uniform's now a mini skirt, and I read one comparison of her to Uhura.
Uhura?
Uhura, yeah, that's what I was trying to say. And that she even sits, like, she has a similar outfit on now, and she even sits a couple times at the, at least in this episode, at
The
like a
helm.
communications kind of
Well, she,
station.
well, when the scene did open up with her at the helm of the starship,
Yeah, that's
and
true.
in other words, it reminded me of Battlestar Galactica and that where Adama and that other guy, I can't remember his name, but they would always switch seats. You know, like Adama's like, okay, my shift is over, you take over. You know, and that seemed like with that admiral, I think it was an admiral. He basically came and said, "Okay, I'll take the shift," and then Wilma went and did whatever she was going to be doing. But the only scene this you mentioned already, the only scene that seemed like it was from the old Buck Rogers was the scene where he was flirting, and then Wilma showed signs of jealousy. You know what I mean? In other words, she was gonna tap him on the back and say, "Hey, Buck," you know, and start chatting. And she saw that he was flirting with somebody, and she got really pouty.
Yeah, the Admiral that you mentioned is one of several new characters added this season, and they're replacing, there's quite a few characters that are no longer on the show, including Dr. Hewer.
That was another big hit. At least I thought, because this other doctor is much older, and he seems more like an archivist. You know what I mean? Like he just wants to know everything.
Yeah, he's one of the other new characters is the Dr. Goodfellow. He's played by a British actor named Wilfred Hyde White. I mean, as far as his credits and stuff goes, seems like he's by this point had a really long career, but mostly in England. A lot of like British productions and stuff, but so I mean, he's a very long experienced actor, but his Yeah, he plays sort of like the scatterbrained professor, and that's real insistent on telling everybody is. He seems like a gentle figure, but he's always telling all of like the scientific information and archaeological information to other characters who. He's like that person that's really into something and doesn't quite pick up on the fact that like, the people he's talking to aren't quite as excited about it as he is. But yeah, the Admiral, his name's Ephraim Asimov, the character. And
Oh
apparently he's
yeah,
supposed
I
to be the.
remember that, like Isaac Asimov, that's what I thought of.
Yeah, well, they imply actually that he's the ancestor of Isaac Asimov. Because there's a new robot named Crichton, and
I did like that because he's like an asshole.
he
Oh,
is,
he's like an asshole robot.
yeah. And when they're talking to him over the comm, he says something to the Admiral along the lines of, "Well, I must obey you because of the stupid rules that your ancestor set down," and Isaac Asimov's. Science fiction, one of the most famous things that he came up with and got applied and picked up by other authors outside of his writing was the rules of robotics, like how robots should behave. And there's certain laws, and one of them is obeying humans and not harming humans. So, yes, they made an allusion to the fact that this admiral is Isaac Asimov's, ancestor, so.
Has a lot to do with like comics too, like Magnus Robot Fighter and Robo Hunter and stuff like that, where it was like a turning point with robots. It's like robots were always supposed to obey the human. And even that movie iRobot, which might have been based on what the Asimov did, but
Yeah,
the
that's the
whole
Asimov story is called
iRobot.
iRobot, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like it's like when they start to gain intelligent programming that makes them feel like they're human or above human. Like in Robot Fighter, a lot of people just they get lazy. They let robots do everything. And finally they just certain robots get the power to think and think
Yeah.
they're better and above what their human counterpart is, and that's what this robot is. He totally thinks like he's basically reading stuff by the millennium, right? He's catching up on history when they interrupt him. He's
Right,
like learning all the recordings of everything ever told, and they're like, come to the bridge because there's a ship. It's unidentified and we need to know what this ship is. So he like goes up there and he's got like a really long neck and he has to like lower his neck to get into the bridge. And it seems like his preferred state is with his neck all the way up to be above the human.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't really think about it that way, but yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, he doesn't even believe, he refuses to believe that Dr. Goodfellow created him, and that is the truth. He was created by Dr. Goodfellow, but he refuses to believe that. He refuses to believe that something like as perfect as him could be created by a
A
human.
human, a
So, I mean, yeah,
human.
his personality was funny and kind of a cool addition. I wasn't as crazy about his actual design. I mean, I now that you mentioned the thing about his neck and stuff, that's kind of interesting. But also, he's just kind of weird looking,
Yeah,
I guess, as compared to
he
Twiggy.
wasn't as sophisticated as Twiggy, but I would say he had a more important role in the episode than Twiggy.
Yeah, Twiggy didn't do too
Twiggy
much at
didn't do
all.
shit.
No.
There was one table scene where they were having breakfast, or and Dr. Goodfellow comes to the table and introduces himself to Wilma and Buck. They already know him, but he's just there chatting with them, and Twiggy's there making some snide remarks. But other than that, he's a waste of time on the screen, Twiggy.
Yeah, it's I'm interested to see. I think it's like the sixth or seventh episode of the season. This actually was a two-parter that we just watched, that we're talking about now, but that Mel Blanc comes back, and I'm interested if in between now and then if he continues to be kind of on the sidelines, and if so, if he has more prominence once Mel Blanc comes back, because
It even
it
seemed like their relationship was degraded.
yeah he
Like
doesn't
him and like but he was Buck's best friend.
right
Like they would go back and forth and that was his companion.
right
When
they don't
Wilma wasn't
spend time
around or
together.
any of the it's like that was who was with him like almost 24/7. And this robot Twiggy just did, and Theopas wasn't there, right? I don't remember
Right,
Twiggy
no, yeah,
wearing
no
Dr. Theopas.
Theophilus.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how it goes along as the season goes on, but I wonder if the producers felt that he was more akin to the campier nature of the show, and that maybe they were wanting to downplay the Twiggy, but we'll kind of see how the other episodes go. But they seem to last season be using Twiggy a lot and featuring him a lot and sending him on most of Buck's missions with him, and
Yeah.
he really is not a part of these episode the story much at all.
It's almost like whoever the producers were or whatever felt forced into a formulaic Star Trek. Whereas I thought the first season of Buck was very identifiable. In other words, it was you could distinguish it from other sci-fi pretty easily. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's one of the reasons that it holds up, and I had a really good time watching the first season and just the campiness, and it just made it fun and amusing. I had a good time talking about it, and I'm not saying that this episode was terrible, but or that I won't find anything to enjoy out of this season, but I don't necessarily think that the changes were good ones. It also doesn't mean that, this episode or the rest of the season might not have things to enjoy about them. But I don't necessarily think that the changes were good ones, and that's probably supported by the fact that it was a shortened season and got canceled. So I think that there was it's like a situation of don't fix if it's not broken kind of thing. But there is so this two-parter is called Time of the Hawk. It originally aired January 15th of 1981. And the other new character this season to join the cast is pretty much the focus of this story. It introduces him. He's Hawk. We've mentioned it before that there's this new character. He's not a human, and he will not be happy with you if you call him that. But
Human.
yeah, he is a birdman. But
Yeah, with a birdman without wings, but he's got like a bald eagle head.
I mean, it's basically a hat kind of that the actor's wearing. We really, of his people, we meet him, and then the guest star for this episode is his mate Corey, played by an actress named Barbara Luna, who the only credit I saw that stood out for me was that she was speaking of Star Trek in an episode called Mirror Mirror, where she played a character named Lieutenant Marlena Moreau. If you look that up, she looks pretty different because, being a bird character, she's got the helmet or whatever you want to call it, the bird thing, and she's also more prominently. I think that Hawk has something too, but her the top of her bird hair or whatever you want to call it.
Hello.
Actor named Tom Christopher, and other than this, it seems like he's still kind of known for doing this role. The other thing that he's known for is he was on a couple soap operas for a long time, I
Yeah,
guess.
that's what Barb recognized.
Did
But
she? Okay.
yeah, I lost you there for a second when you were talking about the top of her head.
Oh, I was just saying that it doesn't come down as far on her forehead, so
Like
you
Hawks
can,
is low. Yeah.
yeah, and his comes down almost to his eyebrows, and so it makes it a little easier to see that she's got, and I assume both of them do have like kind of weird eyebrows and eyelashes.
Yeah.
Her especially,
Her
it stands out.
hers is very noticeable. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the effects were pretty decent, especially I like the design of the Hawk ship. Very Thanagarian. I kept on thinking of Thanagar every time I saw the ship, but like if this was Hawkman and Hawkgirl.
Yeah, I'm
So
surprised I didn't think of that.
but it had like talons and it had a pretty cool design, and the searcher design was pretty nice, and the effects were better than like the finale of Buck Rogers, where it seemed like the effects were really weird. They seemed back to the normal as far as I could tell.
Yeah, they might have been running out of money towards the end of the season or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say the special effects seemed okay. The actual like set design and stuff seemed a little cheap.
Yeah, that one scene where they're like at the flea market, it looked exactly like the flea market in the first season.
Yeah.
You remember that where there was the magician? It looked exactly like that same flea market. And then he goes up to those. It's such a weird planet because they don't like have ships or anything. Well, let's go back into the plot because we have to
Yeah,
get there.
probably jumping ahead, yeah.
So what happens? The scene opens up and Hawk and his woman are returning back to their planet, and they find out that their people have been wiped out. And they do find one gun, and there's one human there, and he blames humanity for the death of his people. So It turns out to be a vengeance thing, and it gets to the point where he's known throughout the gal, you know, throughout this area as killing every human ship. And that's the ship that we talked about where they called the robot to identify. They basically board the ship, which is kind of cool because they had like astronaut outfits and stuff, and they boarded the ship, and they found one survivor on that ship, and Hawk had pretty much just slaughtered them all. And they were all the people seemed like they were intact, but their bodies were just like frozen. And it's weird that the bodies weren't like floating because there was like bullet holes everywhere, so the ship must have sustained some kind of like gravity.
Yeah, they probably just
Because
didn't think about
there
that.
were holes in the ship, like, and they essentially froze to death. So, in theory, you know, these bodies would just be floating in the ship. There'd be
Yeah,
no
there shouldn't be
gravity.
any gravity. Yeah, you're right.
But
Yeah,
they walk in there. They discover one survivor, and he pretty much says, "Hawk, you know, he's killing us all." So then they're on a journey to find this Hawk guy.
I wrote down that Buck goes says, and it's delivered straight. I don't think it was meant to be a joke, but when the guy keeps saying Hawk, Buck says, "Are you trying to tell me the thing that did this is a bird?" But I mean, what else would you think, right? But yeah, so he goes looking for him,
Yeah,
and
so they essentially are able to narrow it down to a planet. And he goes down on a shuttle. And this planet is very weird. I kind of don't understand it. It seems very like what would you say, covered in forest and stuff, but there's one area that's like heavy populated and dense. And that one area, they're like known for fixing stuff. Like that's what they're good at. They fix ships, but they don't produce ships. That's really weird. It's like people will port there and get their ship fixed and then leave. And what's really cool is he runs into these guys and he's like, "Man, you'd make a hell of a black basketball team," but they were all black.
I know, I
And
just
Barb
you
was like, "Man, is that kind of
Exactly.
racist?"
I wrote that down. I'm like, whoa, that's not a good attempt at humor there, guys.
Yeah, he's like, "You'd make a," and they looked really, really tall, except Barb noticed that they were standing on a platform too, like they were above Buck.
Yeah, and they
So
were
like
trying to.
he was looking up. And then they had these hats that were at least 2 feet tall, which made him even look even taller.
Yeah, and it wasn't even just a hat, it kind of wrapped around their face, and then their face, there was just a hole in it for their face, and they were like kind of a like a pinkish yellow color, and they were these straight columns that rose up off their head. So in my notes I have them written down as penis heads. That's
It does
how I
kind of look
refer
like
to
a tip at the top.
them. So it's just like these are some really weird alien design. If
Yeah.
they ever meant to be aliens, I don't know, but
But he starts asking questions, and they know who Hawk is, but Hawk does not want to. Nobody wants to give away Hawk. It's like he's protected by this society, and maybe some of them actually fear him. And then there's this group of, like, they look like mercenaries. And the interesting thing is they brought Sid Haig back. And if you remember, Sid Haig was like in the finale and was killed, but now he's another mercenary. But he's like he's not the lead mercenary, he's like the side henchman. And
Yeah, I was kind of expecting him to do more,
they
but
essentially wanted to take Buck's ship because their ship was being repaired and it wouldn't be ready, and his ship was fully functional, and they needed to get off that planet for whatever reason. And they wanted to rent his ship, which was interesting. They started offering him large quantities of money, and Buck's like, "I ain't gonna take your money. You know, I don't want to rent my ship." And they were like, "We'll buy it for this." Like, and it sounded like an ex the way they enunciated and said the value is like it sounded like it was a huge amount of money, you know. And he still turned them down. And the interesting thing is that he says, "Do you know what Hawk?" You know, like he wanted to barter with them, kind of thing. And he said, "No, we don't know no Hawk," and they don't want to talk to Buck. But What was cool is he, Buck, this is the part that I did really like. I really like this part because he like set a trap for these bastards. He like knew immediately that these guys would come for his ship. So what he did is he went back to his shuttle, and then these guys came into his ship, and I guess he couldn't ha he had no visual monitor outside of his shuttle because I mean he'd see who these guys were. But there was some guy says, "I have information about Hawk. I'll give you the information." And he's like, "Well, tell me the information." He says, "No, we have to talk about this in private. Let me above your ship." And then he lets him in, and it's that mercenary thug, and I don't know his name.
The main guy's name is Flag
Okay.
with two G's, and then Sid Haig's character's name was Pratt.
So
But
Flag and Pratt, and plus there was like three other goons with them, you know, maybe four.
yeah.
They all get into the shuttle. Well, and he looks like Buck is they're gonna take over the ship and take it from him. But then he like lowers one of the doors in the shuttle and then gases them. And I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, it was clever. It was kind of like a foyer or an open, like you know, like a entrance chamber
Yeah.
at the front of the ship. But yeah,
It
that
seems
was
like most
clever.
science fiction ships have that. In other words, it's like a safety barrier between the doors in
Yeah,
case
almost like
something
a
goes, kind of like a sub. Yeah,
decompression chamber or
decompression
something.
chamber, yeah. So it's like they had that and he gassed them and he threw all of them out of the ship and brought in Flag only.
Yeah, Flag. You know who that character or that actor is? If you watched A-Team,
I watch A-Team, but he did look familiar, but I don't know who he was.
he was the colonel, the army colonel that they were always pissing off,
Oh,
Roderick
the one that
Decker.
was the one that was hunting them.
Yeah, that kid, the Magnum.
Oh, okay.
The actor's name is Lance LaGault, but yeah, that's. He's real known for, because he looks familiar to me too. Because I watched A-Team a lot when I was a kid,
Yeah.
and sure enough, that's what he's m mostly known for. But yeah, so Buck ends up tying Flag up because he wants to get the information from
This was a classic scene that made no sense.
him.
Wasn't it kind of funny? That part was funny.
You mean what he, how he threatens him?
Yeah, he threatened him. Go
Yeah.
ahead and say
He
what he
threatens
did.
to embarrass him, basically. He's not gonna hurt him, but he tosses a hula dress or like a hula skirt at him and says that if he doesn't tell him where Hawk is at, then he's gonna dress him up like a lady and make him walk through town or something.
That
He's
was
like,
so
that's it.
well, he like
Interesting.
bondage. He put a chain on him. He's gonna feather, put him a hula skirt, and then put him like a dog leash and parade him around town. And that's what made him spill his guts.
Yeah, I guess he was a really prideful guy. He didn't want to
But
be
that's even
embarrassed.
such a weird, that's such a weird thing that for him to do. That is like, that's weird. I don't know how weird is that? It's like I'm going to put you in a bondage scene and parade you around town.
Definitely strange.
I never think I've seen that in the sci-fi show.
Yeah. But yeah, I think one of the exchanges they have here is Hawk's Buck's just thinking Hawk's a guy, and he says, "You mean Hawk is really a bird?" And Flag tells him, "Part of him is." So there's still kind of like this, like what are these people kind of thing going on, and we get some more history from because we finally get back to Wilma, and she takes Dr. Goodfellow, who insists on going with her because he's so interested in the archaeology of all of this. And
Which was
he
a bad move.
taking him.
Yeah, because it was such a dangerous situation.
Yeah, and he's looks like he's in his 80s or getting there. And yeah, it was pretty dis but he's just in this scene, he's just so enthusiastic about everything that
Yeah,
happens. He's just super excited.
he reminds me of every time I see comic books.
Yeah.
I was like, that's me.
He's like, you to comic books is him to archaeology
Yeah.
and history and stuff. But apparently, according to him, the bird people originated on Earth, actually. There's a connection there to Easter Island that those carvings and stuff are from the bird people. But over time, and we get some from Dr. Goodfellow, and then later from Hawk himself, talks about how humans are came up later after his people, and ended up hunting them. And so the reason that the bird people aren't on Earth anymore is they had to escape to other planets to survive. But yeah, before that, while Wilma and Dr. Goodfellow are in the cave where Corey and Hawk were living, Hawk isn't there, only Corey is. They get trapped by the fakest looking spider web I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a fake spider web. The spider would look pretty legit, though.
The
It looked
spider was real because they were
it looked tiny compared to
exactly.
the web it built. Like, the
They were
web it built
trying
was huge, and the
exactly.
spider looked like it was a pretty good sized tarantula, right?
Right, but yeah, they were trying to do a camera trick where you don't like you show something small, but you don't have any size reference. Like, you know how like sometimes a picture online they'll put like a penny or a pencil next to something to show you the size of it so you have a reference point. And like sometimes in movies like they'll film something that's smaller. I mean, that's they do this with miniaturization, like so that it looks big, and they didn't show anything with the spider in any of the shots. And I think they were trying to use a real spider and then just film it by itself so we could assume that it's huge. But for some reason, the way that they did it, or maybe because tarantula is so recognizable and we know how big tarantulas are, like it just didn't work.
It didn't work. You're
Yeah.
right, because they would just show it like walking on a rock or something like that, and you never knew
Yeah.
the perspective of the rock. But
Right.
for some reason, it didn't work.
No.
It looked small, so I was like, man, that small spider could build a huge web,
Yeah.
and it like the what the female hawk woman was there, and it looked like I thought for a second she had some kind of like mental powers. Like, Hawkman used to be able to talk to the birds in the Silver Age. And I was like, maybe she could talk to spiders because she had like this weird eye contact with the spider. And I don't know if she just w knew the spider was luring him in and had that reaction because she saw the spider. But it looked like the spider dropped the web on him as soon as she gave eye contact, you know? So it's like the web goes on them and it pretty much knocks them out for whatever reason. They pretty much are out. But then you don't see no spider going to the web. You see it walking on the rock still.
Yeah, 'cause this buck comes along in time to shoot the spider with his ray gun
Yeah.
and save them. But yeah, I wonder about Corey's powers because she does at least have some sort of power to reach Hawk, even though he's in space in his ship. She's able to like kind of make like a cry.
Oh, it's like a canary cry. I was like, hawk, hawk, hawk.
Yeah, and that's able to reach him even though he's really far away and call him for help.
Yeah.
Because Buck's really serious. He's not messing around through this part of the episode.
Yeah, he essentially captures her.
Yeah.
But that's a good plot. He's like, I mean, I can't. His strategy is basically, I can't find Hawk, and nowhere
Right.
am I gonna lure. There's no way I can catch him. So what I'm gonna do is I'll take his loved one and let him come to me. That's what his
Yep.
strategy is.
Yeah. Well, that's a smart move on his part. And it works pretty quickly. You were saying the design of Hawk's spaceship is pretty cool. The only thing I would say that was kind of corny is that the shift in his ship, it has a bird head on it. And that just looked kind of corny, but other than that, yeah, it was pretty cool. So pretty quickly, Hawk comes after Buck, and they have basically a space fight. And but
But
Buck's telling him.
it's weird how that whole space fight was very strange to me.
Yeah, he's like, you got to be careful because I have her in here. If you keep firing on the ship, then you're gonna harm your mate. And eventually, they end up, I think, going back into the planet's atmosphere. Does I think where it happens, but Hawk attacks his ship with actual, some kind of actual like mechanism. It's not like he's not firing on it. He's actually using some kind of actual mechanism to connect the two ships, and it pierces Corey and injures her pretty badly. Starts bleeding pretty badly. So Buck tells Hawk that, and he says, "Look, we need to land." And get your wife some help. And they end up making a truce, that they're not going to fight until they get her to safety. So they're on the planet that they were on before the planet with the penis heads. But they land somewhere outside of that city, so they have to work their way back together. They're at least a day or more than a day's journey from the city. So they end up the two guys they end up spending time together as they travel, and slowly the way that Buck acts, it starts to influence Hawk's opinions about humans that maybe they're not all evil. Because Buck is pretty committed to getting Corey to safety, and Hawk, for the longest time insists on carrying Corey, but it gets to the point where he collapses because he doesn't have the strength anymore, and Buck picks her up and carries her for him.
Yeah, kind of I happen to be reading Grayson. Do you read that?
Yeah, I haven't read the last couple issues yet.
Well, this was an older one where they're walking in the desert with the baby.
Oh yeah, was that the annual? I think that was the annual.
No, the annual was more about
Oh no, you're right.
but they were walking in the desert and Midnighter was there and Helena was there, the Huntress version. And they were protecting this little baby, and it kind of reminded me as they're walking, except Grayson's carrying the baby instead of, this hawk lady.
Right, yeah, you're right, yeah.
But the awkwardness of the situation was the same, and it's just
Right.
coincidence that I was reading it this weekend too. So, because Midnighter and Grayson are rivals, even though in the comic book, it's almost like they have no clue that Midnighter is a hero. You know what I mean? He is a hero for Stormwatch, but he's has competing agendas with Spiral, so he's kind of like Hawk, and Grayson was like Buck.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that, but yeah, you're right. Definitely a similar situation.
So they're walking to a healer, essentially a healer that's supposed to heal her, because the one healer on that in that one area couldn't do anything. So they're like, this healer might be able to help, and he seems to have some kind of weird powers too. Like he does the Vulcan thing with his fingers and can do stuff. But they get abducted by by Flag. And the Sid Haig character, I can't remember their names, but they get abducted, and they were like, "We're after you, Buck." And this is was what was really weird. This is like a turning point in the show, because Buck says, "Take her to the healer. I'll hold them off as long as I can." Well, they're not after Hawk.
Right.
They don't give a shit about Hawk. They just want revenge on Buck for what he did to Flag. And if I was Hawk and he loved his mate, he should have just take like what if he did take her there and the healer got to her sooner, maybe she would have been healed. I don't know. But
Maybe, yeah.
instead he puts her down and wants to fight along Buck's side. So
right.
he puts his mate down and goes to fight. And then the healer uses his powers to kind of like put him in stasis, like some kind of like where they can't move. And then Buck and Hawk are able to escape with the woman and get her to the healer, and then he releases them, and they're like, what the hell just happened? We don't want to deal. Flag is like, we don't want to deal with somebody that has powers.
Right.
Let's get the hell out, and they just run off.
Yeah, because it happens to happen right outside of where the healer's cave is at.
Yeah.
So he comes out with the commotion and everything. Yeah, I mean, I guess they were just really just trying to convey the change in Hawk's character, because they have a bond. Hawk and Buck, they do remark on the fact that even though they're opposed to each other, that they're very similar people to each other. So they definitely by this point have a mutual respect, and they're, you know, obviously the show was trying to, or the script was trying to show that Hawk was starting to have starting to care whether something happened to Buck or not, or felt like you owed him for carrying or helping with Corey. But yeah, as you say, they take her up at that point to the healer, who is called the Lama Juna. I guess it's like a take on a Dalai Lama or something. Maybe he's like an older guy who has like spiritual powers and stuff, and he is alone with Corey, and he tells her, basically, I can hold your spirit to your body, but for as long as you like, but it will be an illusion of life. You won't really be alive. And she asks, well, you know, I'd be able to bear children, or et cetera, and he just tells her no, and that, you know, we won't really be alive. It'll just be an illusion, but I could do it for you if that's what you want. And no, she doesn't want to live that way. So she calls Hawk over to her, and she starts to say goodbye, and she just starts to express her feelings for Hawk and tell him how much he's meant to her, et cetera. And so he immediately can tell what she's implying. And I actually thought, I mean, we'll say that Barbara Luna did a good job of acting this role. I thought
she did better towards the end than at the beginning.
Yeah, but
she
I
was
think
first
she
introduced her. Yeah, she pulled off the death and her dying and mm-hmm. really well. I thought when they introduced her, it was like really overacting or something. It seemed really weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought she pulled this off pretty well. I just remember thinking as I was watching it that it was kind of a crazy situation, you know, but that she was making it believable. So once she's passed, she doesn't really have much to live for. Or Hawk doesn't have much to live for at that point. So he goes back to what they originally planned, was that he wasn't going to allow Buck to take him in. But he does, like, Buck's recovering from the situation, and Hawk speaks to him from a nearby clifftop before showing himself, and he is willing to let Buck leave instead of battling. But Buck, of course, can't leave. You know, it's his duty to bring Hawk back. He can't leave without Hawk. So that's basically where they decide that they're going to have to fight. And so Buck starts to climb his way up to the top of the cliff where Hawk's waiting for him. And then they have a fight hand to hand.
Yeah. It's like a Star Trek fight. Without the music.
They do a bunch of choreographed flips and whatnot.
I was impressed with the fight sequence, though, because it looked like Gil Gerard was in on it. I didn't see those like fake stunt people.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there was definitely some stunt actors involved, but yeah, I thought they
It
did a
wasn't
better
as
job.
obvious as the
No.
first season.
They did a better job of keeping the camera angle and the distance of the shot so that it wasn't just blatantly obvious. They were trying at least.
And at least
But
the stunt person looked like Buck instead of a balding 4 foot 2 guy
Right,
or
yeah.
7 foot 8 guy.
Yeah, just not even trying. But eventually Buck falls from the platform that they're fighting on, the part of the path that he falls not all the way down, but just to the next level down. But it's far enough that it's believable that maybe he had fallen and died or severely injured, 'cause, and he just lays there. So Hawk goes down to see, and it turns out that Buck's playing possum. And they're about to start, or they start fighting again, but then the Llama Juna zaps them in the same way that he zapped Flag and his men earlier and freezes them in a stasis. And interesting, it was kind of interesting jump cut here where he zaps the two of them, and then you jump to back onto the searcher, and it sort of jumps ahead in time where Hawk is now captive on the ship and is refusing to speak in his own defense. He refuses to acknowledge the authority of the human courts. So they kind of set up like a court by way of television.
Yeah.
Everyone's assembled in the bridge, and they
That's
have
because I
a
think everybody's at Earth. You know what I mean?
right. Yeah, because they're off in space, so that's why they do it. And they have like some judges that are communicating by way of video. But yeah, Hawk refuses to speak in his own defense, and he's going to be executed basically. And at this point, Buck gets up and has this long, impassioned speech about Hawk and all the losses that he has. It was a very like, I mean, you keep coming back to the Star Trek comparisons and this as we start the season and the changes, but it was a very, I thought it was a very William Shatner-esque kind of speech for him. And was sort of a matching with the differences in Buck's character as we start the season, the more serious business Buck Rogers.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but ultimately, and we kind of know this going in because we know that Hawk's a new character for the show, that they end up the council or the judges, they end up basically saying that Hawk, their compromise is just to say Hawk won't be killed, but he'll be under constant supervision of the Admiral, and Hawk refuses to be again subjugated to their human authority. And but they end up coming up with the compromise, the idea for Hawk to actually accompany them on their journeys.
Kind
And
of like we have a parole officer kind of thing, right? In
yeah.
other words, we'll watch you, but you can help us on the journey to see if we could find your people.
Right, and at first,
And then
and
it turns
that's,
in, it goes from Star Trek to Battlestar Galactica, because
yeah.
that's what Battlestar Galactica's goal is, to find the people of Earth.
Yeah,
Now
it
we're
really
trying to
is.
find the Birdmen.
Exactly. Well, and it's a combination of things, because it is literally the Battlestar Galactica thing in terms of the searcher ship, because Buck explains, after the war on Earth that caused a lot of the damage. A lot of people did leave Earth, so the searchers literally is looking for humans in space, and the way that they sell Hawk on it is they remind them, you're the one that told us that even though you're the only survivor of the bird people on your planet, that you're the one that told us that they went to other planets as well, and it's possible that there are bird people out there. So that's the reason that Hawk is sold on doing it. And I liked it because I thought it was I thought it was a resolution that made sense for the
Yeah.
character. I mean, I don't think Hawk would have really agreed to help them under any other circumstances, but I do see that I do see him going along to find more of his people. And I don't think this, I don't prefer the changes that they made to the show, but I don't think that the episode was a bad plot necessarily.
Oh, I agree. And I think the first 10 minutes were a shock to my system. And then once I started watching it and stuff, I became more vested in it. And I was like, this is still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily prefer it to the setup of the previous season, but it's not. I thought there was still some stuff that I got out of it. I think ultimately, I mean, the Hawk's design is not the greatest. It's not super convincing as far as him. I mean, because he just really just does look like a human with a hawk hat on.
It's true, but his costume is not bad. It's all black, like kind of like a condor would look, you know, like you got the hood, you know, underneath it. And then if you look at his arms, they kind of have like wing, they're hard to see, but they're kind of like wings on them in the plastic. Like they're definitely not made for flight, but it's symbolic of his people 'cause they used to have wings.
Yeah, but that, I mean,
It's
the
like the Star
idea.
Belly Sneetches, you know, like Dr. Seuss, you know. They had to lose their wings to look more human. You know, had to devolve themselves because they felt threatened.
Yeah, it was the idea of the character and the race and stuff, I think is it works. It's interesting.
I don't remember too much of the season other than Hawk. I mean, I watched these as kids, as a kid, but I might have left this season. I might have like watched one or two episodes and then stopped because I don't remember anything but Hawk. This was I had no fond memories like the first season where I like knew episodes and I remembered characters. The only one I remembered from the second season was Hawk.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's going to be worth watching. It's interesting, even just
Yeah.
from a historical perspective of what they decided to do with the show and how it didn't really work out. I'm kind of interested to see how the season goes.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how the next episode goes.
Yeah, because this is almost establishing the new status quo, because it's so much about why, it's easy for them to introduce the other characters. They're just assigned to the ship and they're humans, but getting this Hawk character into a place where it makes sense for him to be on the ship, took 2 episodes, and now that that's established, it kind of completes the new status quo of this episode or the of the show. So it'd be interesting to see his Hawk as part of the crew and not the focus of the story.
Yeah.
But he is kind of like the Spock,
Yeah, I'm really curious to watch the rest of the season 'cause like I said, I don't remember it. Whereas the first season, I remembered a lot of the episodes. I think I remembered like 75%. Not like in grave detail, but I knew the general plots. And I remembered the actors' faces and I knew stuff. This is kind of new, a new venture, so it should be fun. All right.
Cool.
Well, I just want to talk about some recent comic purchases I did.
Sure.
I found out when I was auditing stuff that I was missing some Valiant. I thought I had finished it, but there was like two Turok magazines that I was missing, and I was able to acquire them in a Facebook acquisition, so that worked out well. And then I still have two Turok books to get, and then I just received Turok 3, which was based on the video game. And the last one I have to get is Turok Evolution, which I'll probably purchase, which is the last published book of the first Valiant universe.
Oh, okay.
So once I get that, I'll have everything. Not, I mean, everything comprehensive except for all the special editions. Do you know what I mean? Like the gold covers and all that stuff. But as far as content,
The
and the
actual
interesting thing
issues.
about Valiant too is I've read it all except for these Turok issues. The other thing I started to get was Acclaim started to put out crime noir books, and I purchased the Armin Dangerous. One of them I'll be talking about in this episode, because it was really good. It's kind of like Sin City, kind of in that flair. And then I picked up my oldest Wonder Woman comic from the 40s. It's from Sensation Comics number 46. Pretty beat up outside. It's a detached cover, but the cover is intact. And the paper quality is really nice. And it's got a Wonder Woman story. It's got some comedy stories. It's got a Wildcat story and a Mr. Terrific story. It is
Oh,
awesome.
cool.
It is an awesome comic. I'm so glad I got it. And the other one I got was Wonder Woman number 88, which is like a Golden Age 10-cent issue as well. And so I'm starting to work on some older Golden Age stuff.
Nice.
And this week I should acquire two 1940 Dollmans, which is the first time I've been able to get any quality comics before DC acquired them. And I've always loved the Freedom Fighters. I could just never find their books, and I found two Dollmans, so.
Coincidentally, that I actually read an issue of the 70s Freedom Fighters series t for this today.
Oh God, I love the Freedom Fighters, so I look forward to that.
Yeah. Let's take a quick bathroom break.
Yes.
Just pause it for a second.
Sure.
All right, I'll be right back.
We're back.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, thanks. I drank too much water this morning, I guess.
It'll probably hit me in a few minutes. It just hasn't yet.
Yeah.
I already drank one full bottle of water, and now I'm on a Pepsi, so
It doesn't
it's not
usually hit
gonna.
me till later in the show, but I don't want to pee my pants.
Oh, Barb wanted to mention you had talked a bit briefly that Hawk was in soap operas, but she wanted me to mention that Hawk was in One Life to Live for Alan. I guess he used to watch that soap.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember the name of the show, but it looked like he was on it for a long time.
He's Barb said he was well established, so I didn't know which soap opera, so when you mentioned it, I didn't like chime in, and as soon as I had said that, she had heard, and she came and wrote something on my notebook.
Yeah, I remember seeing something on Facebook where somebody posted an actor that was on a soap and. And Alan was really breaking down the knowledge. He knew a lot about the history of the character or something. Soap opera.
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'll start off and I'll talk about the Armed and Dangerous because I kind of like segued into it.
Yeah, sure.
So I Arm they there was this imprint from Acclaim Comics called Armada, and it seemed like it did a lot of stuff. They put out like Magic the Gathering comics and some licensed Baywatch comics, and they explored in crime noir, and I think some of them are even available on Comixology. So I don't know if that means that Valiant acquired them. I think you could buy the Grackle 1 through 4 on there, and maybe Armed and Dangerous. But this is written and drawn by Bob Hall, and Bob Hall is kind of the co-creator of West Coast Avengers, so he's kind of that's what he's known for. As far as like popularity, but he's also known for his work on Shadow Man, and that's what I knew him from. He's also been an editor, but like he's done a few DC pieces of work. There some Batman issues, some Chase issues, but they're like sporadic and they're one shots. So he did do Weird War Tales and did quite a, you know, he did like 4 issues of that in 81 and 82. And then Marvel Comics, he did some Amazing Spider-Man, some Avengers, some Champions, which is one of my favorites, Defenders. And he's an artist too. So on some of these, he might have been just an artist. West Coast Avengers, the mini series, which spawned off the main series. So he's done a lot of work. He what I knew him from was Shadow Man. He did Shadow Man Zero in quite a few issues, like 26 through 43. That's a pretty good run. And then 10 through 12, 14, and 19. He did quite a bit of Shadow Man. Well, I was interested in this Crime Noir Acclaim imprint. I still don't have the Grackle or the other one yet, but I'm going to get them very soon. So I bought this Armed and Dangerous series, and man, I thought it was just so top notch. I read all 4 issues, and it's black and white. It's very dark pencils. It's weird because in the last issue, he has some of the FBI agents and cops doing it, and it's very like light background. But like when it's the mafia guys and stuff, it's all darks. Do you know what I mean? It's really dark. So he introduces some characters. The main character is Eddie, and he was in boarding school, and his father was killed. So he's coming back from boarding school, and his cousin picks him up. And his cousin is a main character in the series too. His name is Doogie. He's a young taxi cab driver. Man, this reminded me of Taxi Cab, Taxi Driver.
Oh yeah. Interesting.
It had so many elements of it. But Doogie picks him up, and he's supposed to meet his uncle Mitch, because Mitch is the one that called for him. Well, Mitch is a cleaner. What he does is people call him, and they basically say, "We murdered so and so. Can you dispose of the body? Or can you take the body and put it out where people can see it so we can send a message?" So that's like Mitch's job. And he wants to train Eddie in this. And Eddie's still in high school. So, like, he's coming back to school. And one of the first things he does is he's coming back. His mom's an alcoholic. She loses her husband. She becomes an alcoholic. At least he thinks she's an alcoholic, but she's also into heroin. So she's like just fucked up. And she doesn't make a lot of appearances and such. She has maybe 8 total panels with her son, and she's lost her mind pretty much. So he's caught in this situation where he's coming back to school. He runs into a girl immediately, Lana. And he's like, "Oh God, I love Lana before I left to boarding school. She's like the most beautiful thing. She's the sexiest thing. I think I'm getting a boner just looking at her." He sees her, and she's a prostitute. And she's like 15 or like 16, kind of like the Jodie Foster character, except she's more drugged out. Like, she's doing this, and her pimp, whose name is Slick, is very abusive to her. He'll beat her. He does, like in Taxi Driver, he seemed abusive, but he'd always say, "Oh, I love you, honey." You know, he would manipulate her more through emotion, whereas in this comic he manipulates her by beating her. And he basically says, "If you leave me, you're not going to get your drugs. You're not going to I'm not you're not going to get I'm not going to be able to feed your crack habit. What are you going to do now?" So she can't leave. But Eddie really wants to hook up with her, but he has runs in. Slick is always like wanting to beat the shit out of him because he didn't like his father, because his father was in the mafia. But the first scene is pretty cool because Mitch says, I want you to come help me with the body." So they kill this guy named Gumshoe because he used to chew gum all the time, and their bodies to just. Their whole job in the first comic is to dispose of the body, so they have to like cut it up, and he's like vomiting, and he's just a kid. He doesn't know how to deal with it, but his uncle's teaching him how to do it, and he has to like bag up the head, bag up the arms, And they basically take the body to a laundromat where the guy that they're trying to mess with owns that laundromat. So they put the body parts inside of a dryer, set it to spin, and leave. So that was like the first opening scene. And it kind of like is a story where he's trying to discover why his father was killed, his father Harry was murdered. And it takes you on twists and turns, and in the first four issues, you don't get to any conclusion other than they establish more of the relationship between Slick and Lana, the relationship between Mitch and Doogie. Like, Doogie's always like hitting on women, and there's this girl called like Roller Girl, kind of like in that movie with
Oh
Mark
yeah,
Wahlberg.
Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights, where they had that roller girl. Well, there's a roller girl in this comic, except she's an assassin. But Doogie's like infatuated with her. He'll see her, skating around town, and he like follows her, and she like totally flirts with his ass, and he can never catch her. But she's an assassin for Arco, which is he's one of the guys that was with Eddie's father, Harry, and Charlie Donovan, who were the guys in the mob, and now they're gone, and all that's left is Arco, and he seems like he might be the killer of Eddie's father. So yeah, this series is really, really good, and I'd highly recommend it if you're into crime noir. It's only four issues, and there's no conclusion yet, but one of my other comics I'm going to talk about is the special edition, and then there are four more issues after that. So I don't know if that like concludes it or if it just like leads you on to another arc that never ever happened because the company went bankrupt. So I don't know like what the future of the series is, but it's interesting as this kid is coming into grips with working in the mob and he's starting to like it. For instance, there's this coach in his high school, and he has all the kids that are in his PE class beat the shit out of Eddie, and because he was his brother was a police officer and was murdered by his father, the mafia. So he picks on Eddie like constantly, and Eddie finally belts him, and then he gets Eddie expelled. But he goes to Mitch, who's his uncle, who's the cleaner, and tells him what's happening. And Mitch is like, "Well, do you want me to take care of it?" And Mitch essentially gets pissed off and sends two guys after him, and essentially blow up his Porsche, the coach's Porsche. That's like, he's not a rich coach, but the one thing he loved was cars. They blow up his car and then break his nose and threaten him. And the next day, the coach is on his knees in front of all the PE teachers saying, "Please forgive me." And Eddie's like, "Maybe I'll forgive you. I don't know yet."
Kind of reminds me of The Sopranos.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's got a lot of cool elements. Let's see what year this came out. This was definitely before The Sopranos, I think. And you know what? I've never read Sin City. I've only watched the movies,
Yeah, I haven't
which is really
read it
weird.
either.
But this was published in 1996. So yeah, I'd recommend it. It's fun, and the covers are amazing.
That's cool. Yeah, I've never even heard of that imprint before. I mean, it looks like they didn't do a ton of stuff, like you said. A lot of it was licensed, and most of that was Magic the Gathering
Yeah,
stuff, but.
they messed a lot with it almost makes me wonder why Acclaim went bankrupt. At some point, I'm going to have to research that, but I think it was their video games that finally went. They were costing them, but I always wonder, like, were their comics still viable, and they just went under because of everything else? Because
Yeah,
they
because
had imprints. They had Windjammer imprint, which was like it took a lot of Neil Adams stuff and reprinted them, and took Mike Grell. They started to like take popular series like Star Slayer and stuff and start publishing those. So yeah, I'd be really interested to see why they really tanked.
Yeah, because I still think of them more as a video game company than a comic book one, even though, it's, I don't know. I mean, it seems like as time went on, they got more and more into the comic book side of things, but I think it may have initially started out as a supplemental thing, as a promotional thing beyond the video games. Then they decided to add more and more, but I
Well,
don't know too
I
much
know
about
that
it.
when they acquired Valiant, that they started to publish a lot of video games based on Valiant. You know, like we saw Shadow Man, we saw like three Turok, maybe four Turok video games. We saw an EXO Iron Man video game. So like they were putting out. There might have even been. I think there's even an Armorines video game. If you look at it, so they did take a lot of the properties that they acquired Valiant for a reason. They thought they could make these video games successful. I think Turok was probably their most successful one, but because
Yeah,
they did spawn sequels and stuff.
I think I played the first Turok game.
Do you fondly remember it, or no, not really?
No, clearly it's not a strong memory for me. But I know I knew it as a comic property because I didn't get really into Valiant or didn't buy a lot of Valiant. They were kind of coming around towards the end of when I was collecting for the first time, and also they were tough to find for me, the way that I was too young. I was before I was driving and stuff, so I was dependent upon my parents or my friends' parents to when I would get to the comic shop and stuff. So it was too hard to keep up with. Ex It was easy to keep up with the real popular titles. There's always enough copies, but anyway, I do remember I had Turok number one. That was one of the few Valiant comics I had back then.
I think it's one of their best sellers ever. That chromium or whatever that fancy cover was.
Yeah, I think it
It
was
was
kind of a
definitely in the
gold cover, wasn't
millions.
it? But yeah. All right. Well, I might as well do the comic I alluded to or mentioned as well. This was the. I have a couple issues of the Freedom Fighters 70s series. This, I believe, if I looked into it correctly, I think this is basically when they launched this series because they had acquired the quality characters. I read issue number four because that was the earliest one I have. But I think when they launched Freedom Fighters number one, that was the first time a lot of these characters had appeared in quite a while, right? Does that sound
Yeah,
right?
the quality characters has a pretty extensive library. They had Plastic Man, they had Black Hawk. Even though Black Hawk, I don't think originated at quality, they came out of there. They had a lot of characters that showed up in All-Star Squadron and stuff like that, you know, like Firebrand and a few others. Their most popular was like Uncle Sam, Phantom Lady, the Human Bomb, you know, which actually I think prior to the Freedom Fighters, they never teamed up. The Freedom Fighters was a way of bringing all those properties into one team.
Yeah, because
And
if you
I think
look at
around this time Plastic Man was coming out too, like DC relaunched Plastic Man.
Yeah, because if you look at Mike's Amazing World of Comics for Freedom Fighters number one, that began the series, the listing of the previous appearances for all the members of the team prior to Freedom Fighters number one are all different comics.
Yeah,
It's, in
they were
other words,
like,
isn't it just all coming from like the last volume of Freedom Fighters or anything like that?
Yeah, Police Comics, I think, was Human Bomb and Phantom Lady and Military. Well, no, Military Comics was. I can't remember where Uncle Sam came from. It probably says in that Mike's Amazing World.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get an Uncle Sam comic. Like I said, I'm working on my first Doll Man's. I have that back issue spotlight on quality characters, and I was walking Harley this morning, and I was listening to the Fire and Water podcast, and they did a spotlight. One of the hosts and a guest that they tend to specialize in like bloggers. Like these guys were bloggers of Firestorm and Aquaman, and then they tend to find all the niche bloggers, the ones that focus are the experts on certain character. And they were talking about Plastic Man, and as they were talking about it, I was like, man, I really want to read up on this, and I might try to acquire a Golden Age Plastic Man just to have it, but like I have a lot of Captain Marvel Jr. comics, and now Wonder Woman and Batman and Superman. Like I, that's another book I just acquired. The first appearance of Mr. Mxyzptlk.
Oh,
Yeah,
that's
it's not the best shape. The it doesn't have a back cover. The cover itself is in good shape, but there's no back cover. But the pages are all intact, and it's really, really nice. It's pretty awesome looking, with the exception of that back cover missing.
Yeah, it's kind of something you gotta, unless you want to, when you're getting into older comics like that, you kind of have to accept those flaws.
Yeah. But I want to hear what you have to say about this, because one of my first comics off the spinner rack, well, not one that I purchased off the spinner rack, was Freedom Fighters with Wonder Woman on the covers, and I've always like been attached to the characters just because some of the first things you see are some of the things that you love the most, because it just opens your eyes to a world of stuff you didn't realize you were out there. That's why I've always went towards these characters that are obscure.
No, I know what you mean, because I think one of the reasons I have a I kind of like the weird, obscure characters is because one of the first comics I read was Avengers 273, I think it was, where the Masters of Evil are there, and they have such a large group of obscure supervillains in their group. And I just remember just being a kid and looking at it and them being fascinated by all these weird characters.
Yeah.
But
You know what's really fun is to take that and try to acquire or read the first appearances of all those characters because they meant so much to you. So if you could find them like on Marvel Unlimited and say, oh, this is the first appearance of the Wrecking Crew or whatever, you know? Or the Masters of Evil did have the Wrecking Crew, didn't they?
Yeah,
That
they,
time.
most of them, yeah, we're all in
Because I
there, yeah.
remember them in the mansion. They're the ones that beat the crap out of Jarvis, right?
Right, yeah, that was the start of that Siege storyline where they took apart Avengers Mansion. But yeah, I mean, I've been definitely into and enjoying 70s DC stuff, and I want to get and read more of that 70s pre-crisis era DC. This series is interesting because the first, I think, three issues were written by Jerry Conway, and then you have this issue was written by Martin Pasco, and he wrote a few issues, and then you have someone else coming on, and you have different artists doing three or four books, and I think it was about 15 issues that the series lasted, and it didn't have a consistent creative team throughout the whole thing.
A lot of those series that they like the implosion or whatever they called it, the explosion, they weren't successful. And I think one of the reasons was constantly changing the creative team. Like constantly. secret society of supervillains constantly changing, it just
Yeah,
a
there was a
lot of
lot of
those
them around
series
here.
are just bouncing around.
Yeah.
Like, let's get the property out there and start playing with it, but we have no consistent vision other than what the editor's giving,
Right. But the art on this issue is really good. It's actually Ramona Freyden.
Oh, do you see the picture I have with her? I took my picture with her.
Yeah, Den wasn't like that last year at one of the cons or
Yeah,
something.
at
Yeah,
Denver,
that's really
yeah.
cool. Yeah, she's of course known as an Aquaman artist,
And I do have, and Metamorpho. She's known for
and
Metamorpho.
Metamorpho for creating him. Yeah.
Yeah. So man, I have two of her sketches too, like original sketches. One of them's Plastic Man, and the other one I think is Metamorpho.
Yeah, that's really cool. 'Cause that's someone like that. She's a big part of comic book history, you know?
Especially for the time she was doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like a lot of, she was like one of the first known women in the bullpen of men,
Yeah. I was actually, after reading the issue, I was reading about her a little bit, and one of the things I found interesting was I got into reading about the one of the other things she did outside of DC Comics was the newspaper strip Brenda Starr, which I never really knew anything about, and I was
They made a movie of it with Brooke Shields.
oh, did they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
We'll have to
I
watch that if we can track
yeah.
it down.
Oh yeah, that's right. 1986. Interesting. Yeah. No, I didn't know anything about this about Brenda Starr, but again, I found it really interesting because the creator of Brenda Starr, Dale Messick, was actually a woman. Her real name was Dahlia Messick, and she used the name Dale so that people would think that she was a man and would actually look at her work or,
Yeah.
submitted it through mail or whatever. And she worked on, she created Brenda Starr and, worked on it. But then she did it for 40 years from 1940 to 1980. Then when, but the strip continued to run until 2011, but it was always done by women. And when she stopped drawing it, she continued to write it for a couple of years, and Ramona Freyden became the artist. And then Ramona continued to work on it until 1995, actually. So yeah, I don't know, it's kind of just interesting things
She
that you find out about.
she's a fantastic person to meet. If you ever get a chance, spend some time at her table and talk to her.
Yeah,
I
that's
love
cool.
it. I've talked to her at three conventions, and every time I see her at a convention, I pick up a piece of her work. And she usually draws them and then puts them on her table. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She like pre-draws them
Right.
and but they're so good. I mean, there was a couple pieces that were like at 200, 300, but they had like multiple characters, and you don't know how bad I wanted it. It
Yeah.
just was a little bit beyond my budget.
Right.
But maybe this year, I don't know. I seem to be in so much of the back issue stuff though
Right.
that I am in the sketches right now, and yeah, we'll see. But let's get to Freedom Fighters.
Yeah, so Freedom Fighters issue number 4, it's actually guest starring Wonder Woman. Because this issue was just like made for you. But,
You know how
and
much I love Wonder Woman.
yeah, on the cover, it's Wonder Woman up in the air. She's got Uncle Sam lassoed.
Oh, this is
And
my first comic.
oh, this is
This is
the
it. Yeah, this is the first one that I came across.
one? That's
I
hilarious.
picked this up off the spinner rack. Yeah.
Nice.
I bought it with my own money. I was like, well, for one thing, I've always been attracted to Wonder Woman comics.
Right.
And I was like, what is this comic? And who are these guys?
Yeah.
And I've always loved the human bomb. I just find him fascinating. You see him there with the fist on the cover? It
Yeah.
looks so awesome. I just love the guy. Somebody did a song called I Don't Want to Be the Human Bomb, and I can like listen to that song over and over again. It's on YouTube. And he like just pulls off his glove and blows shit up. And
Yeah.
I don't know, he's very simplistic, but and Palmiotti and Gray have done a lot of stuff with that character. Like in the 90s he had an all black character, a black costume, and I wasn't too enthused with the redesign because I always liked the white nuclear look, you know,
Right,
a
yeah.
nuclear suit. But he did an awesome thing where he like blew the shit out of like a whole, almost a whole city. He like pulled off one of his fingernails and threw it and just blew the shit out of everything. I'm like, oh man. Yeah, I'm gonna have to look for that song if I can find it and put it at the beginning of this song, The Human Bomb.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty funny in this issue too, but yeah, he's standing, 'cause he doesn't fly, so he's standing on top of a nearby building, shooting his fist out at Wonder Woman, so and Phantom Lady's standing on the building too. And then you have Black Condor, the Ray, and Doll Man are also kind of flying in. The Ray's shooting a ray at Wonder Woman. She's deflecting it with their bracelet. So it's a pretty cool. It's an Ernie Chua cover.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. But yeah, it starts off really.
I love this comic, so I am so excited.
That's so funny that, yeah. So it's called The Left Hand of Oblivion, and it really starts off like it really grabs you, because the freedom fighters are forcing their way into the United Nations building, and you're like, what the hell's going on? Because the first several pages of the book, it's actually the freedom fighters are fighting the security guards. They're not like severely injuring them, but they're definitely. It starts off right away with a battle, and Doll Man is like punching the security guards in the eyeball, and like they don't want to fight, but they're not going to be allow themselves to be delayed. So the ray is blinding them, and they're just not going to be denied entry into the delegate room. And I was reading out loud, like I know you like to do, because of Uncle Sam's dialogue. It's so funny. I wouldn't do that if I was you, young feller. The mood I'm in, I got a hankering to wallop somebody a good one. So, unless you want to be you, let go of my arm. They're like, listen, Gramps, I don't care how old you are, or maybe even senile. And Uncle Sam grabs him and flips the dude over his shoulder. Sonny, you were warned. That strong arm was bad enough, but I don't cotton to talk like that from nobody know how.
I tend to like to read all my comics out loud. Matter of fact,
That's awesome.
when I'm on the deck, I probably drive my neighbors crazy because I'm out
Like,
there
what the hell
reading.
is that guy doing?
Yeah, Harley sitting next to me, and it looks like probably like I'm reading the story to Harley.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. That's funny though. Like, our crazy neighbor's out talking to himself again. But so yeah, the freedom fighters force themselves into the General Assembly at the United Nations, and we then cut to Diana Prince, who is working there at the United Nations. And when she sees what's going on, is alerted to what's going on downstairs, she's like, I gotta go check this out, but not as Diana Prince. I gotta go down there as Wonder Woman. She thinks back to how she. Because at this point in the continuity, she wouldn't have met the freedom fighters, I guess. So, but she has a flashback where she thinks back to how she just found out about them the day before, where she goes to the district attorney's office, a man named Mr. Pearson, and he goes, she's there as Wonder Woman, and Pearson, he calls her this. The writing on this is actually, there's several moments throughout it where it's pretty humorous, where Wonder Woman walks in and Pearson says, "Do come in, Your Highness." And she says, "Wonder Woman will do, sir." He says, "Certainly, Miss Woman." Just like corny jokes like that. But and he says, "Frankly, Wonder Woman, we need your help." And she says, "Yes, I know. That's why I'm here in man's world." He says, "No, I mean specifically, we need your help with the freedom fighters." And
Is there any explanation between like where they're at? Because the Freedom Fighters weren't even on Earth One, you know?
yeah, they do actually mention that they had come to come from Earth X
Yeah.
recently.
But why are they running in with Wonder Woman?
I'm trying to remember why. Well, they're not on Earth X in this comic. Like
Okay. They're
it
from
mentions that
Earth
they,
X, but they're here on our Earth.
yeah, yes, I think that they came to Earth One at the beginning of the series, I want to say, but because this references back to the reason that Pearson, she's there meeting with Pearson, is that they want her to, yeah. So it's right here. They want her to bring in the Freedom Fighters, and he says, "The Freedom Fighters who recently arrived here from a parallel world we call Earth X. Ostensibly, they came as costume crime fighters like yourself, but within 24 hours of their arrival, they began assisting a terrorist named the Silver Ghost in destroying over $1 million worth of municipal property." So they're actually fugitives at the point that this starts. So, but Wonder Woman's there's almost kind of like a feminist bent to the Wonder Woman scenes, because she's like, "I'm not a bounty hunter, you know." And so Pearson and the other men that are in the room all get like real pissed off at her, and like, "Listen, you came to this fair city, and no one asked you to come here, and nobody says you have to stay. We could send you back where you came from, blah blah blah." She says, "Typical male behavior, flaring tempers, shouting threats. Unfortunately, I can't disagree with you, and you're right that probably something needs to be done about it." But then they show how she has a taller stature, you know, because there's this like bailiff or some kind of guy standing there, and he only comes up to her chest. And she turns around suddenly and asks him, like, "What are you staring at?" And his like eyes are right level with her breasts. "Who, me? I wasn't. I was just noticing your costume." So, but so cut back to the present moment. She, Dinah Prince, goes and she uses her lasso to change her costume and heads down into the delegate room. And it's like, here's a classic twist on an old game, brilliance in bracelets, because she does the deflection thing on Ray's light bolts, because he attacks her almost immediately as she enters. And Human Bomb wants to go after her too, but Uncle Sam grabs him and says, "Hold it, son. It ain't proper for a man to fight a girl. Leave her to the Phantom Lady." So we have like a knockdown, drag out fight between Wonder Woman and Phantom Lady, which is pretty awesome, as illustrated by Ramona Freydan. They're both very beautiful. And it's kind of neat. Wonder Woman tries to lasso Phantom Girl, and so you know, passes right through her, or Phantom Lady. And then Phantom Lady jumps on Wonder Woman and pulls her hair, and Wonder Woman flips her over with her legs and throws her into a nearby table. It's like, "I don't know where you've been, honey, but hair pulling went out with padded shoulders. Unfortunately, I don't have time to introduce you to the 1970s less painfully." Wham! So Wonder Woman eventually gets Human Bomb and Uncle Sam tied up together in her lasso. And like, "This is going to force you to accompany me to Pearson's office." Maybe I should have mentioned this sooner, but I've read about you in the Justice League case book, and for what it's worth, I'm on your side. And it gives you a an asterisk there, that the Freedom Fighters have met the JLA in Justice League 107 and 108, which was a Crisis on Earth X story, but Wonder Woman wasn't there, so that's why she said she read about them in their case book. So they end up going, and it's like, well, I guess we don't have much choice but to go along with the lady. So they end up flying in Wonder Woman's invisible jet. Meanwhile, continuing off of the Silver Ghost storyline that they were talking about from earlier issues, Silver Ghost, he has this device. It's like a special glove, and his henchman, King Samson, who's just like a real, is not a very smart character. When Silver Ghost died, apparently, in Central Park, and so King Samson took the glove from his master, but he doesn't know how to control it, and so he's going to see his mother. And he goes to his mother's, he goes to hug his mother, and he's not thinking, and he touches her with the glove, and it turns her into glass and shatters her. So he blames the Freedom Fighters for this, and vows to get revenge. Well, meanwhile, we go back to Pearson, the district attorney's office, and Dollman, Black Condor, and the Ray have agreed to, unhappily agreed to be put into jail. Well, the rest of the team goes with the Freedom Fighter, or with Wonder Woman, and it's funny that they have Doll Man in a kitty cage, like for transporting your cat to the vet. And this is probably the funniest moment, where he's like, "Human Bomb standing there," and Pearson's like, "Say, sniff, sniff, what's that odor? Don't people on Earth X bathe?" And Human Bomb says, "It's just me, you pompous old windbag. I can't take this suit off the way I could on Earth X. The teleporter that gave Sandy her new power also made all of me explosive, not just my hands. So I can only shower in a special lead-lined chamber back at our headquarters. But I haven't been able to get back there for a week
So he
since your goons
stinks.
have been chasing us all over the city. So if the air gets a little ripe around here, Mr. Pearson, it's all your fault, you turkey."
So he stinks. Human
Yeah.
Bob stinks.
So yeah, but it's like, "You pompous old windbag." So Human Bomb's pissed off, and like Phantom Lady is in the background covering her mouth, trying not to laugh, and Uncle Sam's just got his head in his hands, like, "Oh my God," and Wonder Woman's rolling her eyes. But we do get two panels of Ramona Freydin drawing Aquaman, because Wonder Woman beams up to the satellite, and Aquaman's on monitor duty, and she just goes up there real quick to get some information on whether or not somebody's using the Silver Ghost's devices, because the thing of it is that the Freedom Fighters, not long after arriving to Earth One, they got stuck in a situation where they were forced to help the Silver Ghost. So that's why it's thought that they are terrorists, but they weren't going along willingly. So that's what their Wonder Woman and the other Freedom Fighters are trying to track down, who's ever using the technology now. And just like the continuity that you get these times with there's a reference to Wonder Woman says to Aquaman, "I know Atlantis is going to hell in a handbasket, Aquaman. You're anxious to get back there, but unfortunately, I'm not here to relieve you from monitor duty." And it just there's a little note to see Adventure Comics to learn more about what's going on in Atlantis. So I like little stuff like that. But so anyway, Wonder Woman gets back from the satellite. She beams back down, tells him, "We got some serious trouble going on here." And her and Uncle Sam, Human Bomb, and Phantom Lady head out to track down the Silver Ghost's glove. And they're there just to see King Samson ex used the power of the glove to explode an entire building, throwing people out into the air, so they have to scramble into formation and try to rescue all these people from getting hurt, that get thrown out of the building before they can go after King Samson. And
Is there a scene there where the human bomb saves a kid?
there's a
Oh
little.
my God, I love that scene. He pulls off his glove and the rock is the building is falling on him and he explodes the building.
Yeah, he says, Uncle Sam's like, "We got to get together. We can't let any of these youngsters get hurt." And there's this kid that's lying on the ground, and this rock's falling towards him. And he pulls his glove off and punches at the one rock that's it's like a really huge boulder.
Yeah.
And so, like, he says, "Sorry for the shower, kid, but getting hit by little pebbles has got to top getting hit by a big one, hey?" And the kid's like, "You saved my life."
It's amazing how you can remember things from your when you're a kid. That panel I remember.
Nice. No, I know what you're saying, because a certain, like, some of the first comics I had, I read them so many times because they were the only ones I had, you know? And they really come back to you and stay with you.
I love that panel. Just pulls his glove off, right?
Yeah. Boom. So Wonder Woman's surprised by King Samson because he's able to. He grabs her. She's trying to lasso him, and he grabs the lasso out of the air and snaps it. And she's, "Hades gates, that's impossible." And but it's because of the power of the glove, is the hand that he catches it with. There's something going haywire with the glove. It's not acting properly, and if they don't do something about it, if he keeps using the glove, the bedrock of Manhattan is going to split apart. And Uncle Sam said it'll make the Nazi bombing raids back home on Earth X look like Sunday school picnics. And it actually ends on a cliffhanger. He's like, "Start praying, old buddy. Only Wonder Woman knew just how to stop King Samson." Oh, because so. King Samson smacks Wonder Woman with the glove in the head, and she falls heavily to the ground and does not move. So they actually think that Wonder Woman's dead. So Uncle Sam's like, "Wonder Woman's the only one knew how to stop her, and she's dead. We got to do it now, Roy. But if we don't get it just right, New York City dies." Wonder Woman dead? New York doomed? Be here next issue when the reign of King Samson begins. So this. I love this issue. It was really fun. Very entertaining from start to finish.
Do you have issue 5?
Nope.
Oh, issue 5 has them has Uncle Sam holding Wonder Woman's body and he's like, "Wonder Woman is dead and it's our fault."
Nice. But I thought it was interesting. There's an ad at the end here where DC was having a first edition sale where you could send them $4 plus 69 cents postage and handling, and you got, for each $4 that you sent, you could pick one of five sets of mostly number ones. One set was the Shadow number one, Demon number one, Super Team Family number one, and Stalker number one. There
That's a
was
good I have
another
all
one.
of those except
Nice.
for Super Team Family number one.
There's Shazam number one, Justice Inc. number one, Strange Sports number one, Black Magic number one, and Claw number one.
Think I have all those too except for Strange Sports number one.
Then they had the only ones that aren't number ones is that they have a different set that has Shazam number two in it with Weird Worlds, Beowulf, Green Team Special, and OMAC number ones. I know you have OMAC.
That I don't have the Weird Worlds, any of it. Well, no, I have one of them. I have issue 9.
It shows a picture of it. It's like a Tarzan story or something in it. There's one that has Sandman number one, Plop number one, Joker number one, Champion Sports number one, and Shazam number three. And then finally,
It's weird how they have a bunch of Shazams.
I know, it's weird. That's the only ones that aren't number ones are Shazams, and there's three issues spread out over three different sets. I guess they're trying to get you to buy them. finally, it's one with Tarzan Digest number one, Tor number one, Atlas number one, Batman Family number one, and timely information here, Prez number one.
Ah, Prez!
So that you could get any of those packs for less than $5 at the time.
Yeah, my brother had a bunch of plops, and I don't know what the heck happened to them.
I had a few plops this morning, actually, right after I got up.
Plop.
So, yeah, that was like a humor comic, right?
Yeah, there's amazing covers to that. They're disgusting. You should check them out if you get a chance.
Sounds good.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting ones in there that I need to search. I don't think I have Tor. Is it just Tor?
Yeah, Tor. I think it was a like a caveman.
I know who he is. I just don't. Yeah, I don't have number one. I have 2 through 5. I need to get number one and number six. I think I'm going to buy them today. What the fuck?
You got to buy something. It's an episode of Retrocast. After
yeah.
Why
am I missing two issues out of this damn series? Son of a bitch. You mentioned one title in the plops, I think. And I don't, it doesn't ring a bell. Like, it doesn't sound like it's a title.
That was with Plop?
Yeah, what would you, can you read that again?
Oh, it's probably Champion Sports.
No, I remember that one.
Because the other ones with Plop were
Sandman. Oh, you said Atlas.
Oh, Atlas.
Isn't that first issue special? Atlas?
It might have been. Cause
is
I, that,
there
cause
is
they
no
have
Atlas.
Because they have Green Team Special number one listed, and I think Green Team was just a first issue special, too.
Yeah, those are first issue specials.
I think.
So I'm like, that's not the right title.
Yeah.
They didn't exist.
Right.
I was listening for things that you were mentioning that I knew didn't exist. I was like, how does that?
Yeah. But, the one other thing I was going to mention, what I thought was interesting, that at the bottom of the letters column, it says, as of this writing, editor Jerry Conway is preparing to leave the firmament of DC Superstars to seek greater fortunes elsewhere.
That's Marvel, so, probably.
I thought that was really interesting. I was on, and I was like, well, that must be Marvel, but I'm wondering about, like, what was the timing of that? And it actually lines up when he went and was briefly editor in chief during that time period where, after Roy Thomas, like everybody in New York City was editor-in-chief of Marvel for a short period of time.
Yeah.
And he was really only there for a short period of time and ends up coming back to DC because it wasn't, you know, too long after this that he was writing Firestorm for a long time. So
that didn't last long.
Yeah, he wasn't. Yes. It looks like I think he left to take the job as editor-in-chief and then he was there for a short period of time and then just came back to DC.
Right.
But I just thought that was interesting, like, snapshot there of time.
The one thing I hate is there's just not enough time. God dang it. Like, I want to get into those Freedom Fighters again. Like, a lot of my older books are harder to get to because they're not in the drawer boxes.
Yeah.
So they're stacked on top of each other. So in order to get to them, I'd have to lift 4 rows deep of long boxes, 4 rows high, 4 rows deep to get to the bottom. And I'm like, at some point, I'd really like to get all of it converted to drawer boxes. Because my new setup, and my dad made like these things in case the basement floods where they're elevated.
Right.
So at some point I would just like the one thing I hate, I love comic collecting. I don't mind bagging and boarding. I don't mind doing stuff. But the one thing I hate more than anything, especially with the collection my size, is what I call the merge. And that's like trying to merge all your acquisitions with the old title name. So like if I acquire
Yeah.
4 more Wonder Womans, then I have to merge them at some point. And
Mm
I absolutely hate that. And man, I would it that's one of your first tasks when you come work for Mikey Incorporated,
Yeah.
is you're gonna be a merger.
Right. I was waiting for a pause for it to mention. Yeah, it's like, well, I know how to solve this problem. I need to start my job. But I know what you mean, though. Even if you leave a little bit of space in boxes, and eventually that space fills up, and then
And then what you
you have
then
to
what's
shift like every box after that.
right. Then you do like an empty box, but then you have to shift that empty box into the right location. And it's like, fuck! Because you can only like put so much buffer into the, you can only make it so much space. And if you buy like a full run, like I just ordered a full run of Omega Men because I didn't have it. I have most DC titles, but there are titles that I stayed away from. I don't know why. Omega Man was one of them. I had like one and two, but I just got the full run.
I think a lot of people stayed away from it. I don't think it was. I mean, it was around for a fair amount of time, but I don't think it was ever super popular. And
I guess and the other title I stayed away from was Lobo. Like I don't have a lot of Lobo. I had Lobo's Back, which was the first mini series. But I don't have like hardly any of the ongoing. I have like one and two, and then that's it. So,
I still stay away from Lobo. I have no interest in that
no, but
character.
I need to acquire it. But
No, I know. I don't have the goal that you have, so
yeah,
I
I
can.
have this goal. I need to get this. I just, man, I wish I could do this full time. If I could, that would be heaven. It's just to have enough money to acquire comics and have the collection sorted in a new house so I could fit it all in.
Yeah, I like the house that you and Barb live in and the house that you read comics in.
Yeah. Well, I've been thinking about that. What if I bought a whole house just for comics?
Then maybe you have the space to like to steal away Bob Breitel's record. A challenger approaches.
I think he keeps acquiring though, because I keep seeing all these old issues. He's got more full runs than I definitely do. And the only thing that I could probably catch him with is because I don't think he buys as much new stuff anymore. Whereas still, I'm getting like 200 titles a month, so it could
Yeah.
I could get close if he ever stops. But at some point, God damn, ages sucks. I really wish I was 20 again, you know? I wish I was 20 and I could live forever, but at some point I'm gonna have to say enough is enough, and I hope that's not anytime soon. Not because of it's just life. It's life is too short, and at some point I'm going to have to dump this collection, this Myers collection, and I don't want that to happen soon, but when I retire, I'm pretty sure that's when I'll start dumping stuff.
Yeah, well, you can downsize. I mean, like you could continue to. It's just like I kind
I could
of.
get new comics and keep up with what's going on, but the older issues are going to have to go, or I have to like start, I'll get rid of all the Marvel. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because I want to focus in a certain area, or it'll be like that.
Well, I mean, because I've already done that. I decided, like, I'll keep reading DC and paper. And I pared my collection down to DC stuff. And it's like, I'm not like a super DC fanboy where I shit on other stuff. And I love Marvel and I read a lot of Marvel like digitally. But just in terms of space and just practicalities of living, like you said, I just for me it was already time to say, okay, like I'm just gonna focus my collection. And I still acquire stuff, like I still buy back issues and stuff, but I limit myself, you know. And yeah, like you said, not that you would have to necessarily do that now, but that could be like you decide what's the most important to you, you know, and you could start like selling off some of the of the other company stuff.
Yeah, that's what's hard though, because I love that other stuff too. It's just that if everything had to go, I would keep the DC and Valiant as long as I could. And it's more of a mental thing and attachment to the characters and the history. Like, history is everything to me in that universe. Even if some of it doesn't matter, it still matters to me. Even if they've retconned something, it matters to me. That's history, baby.
Well, yeah, and I don't even agree with the idea that just because it's not current continuity, it's still influencing present day, in terms of the inspiration for the stories. People are still riffing off of, I mean, even though like current day Cyborg is more of a Justice League member than a Titans member, Cyborg is still recognizable as Cyborg. Like, there's certain aspects of his character that are informed by the writers that write Cyborg now are influenced by the things that happened to the character in the past, even if it's not directly referenced,
And he's getting his
But
own series. How about that?
yeah, drawn by a really awesome artist.
Yeah, I'm excited. But my next book is another book that I recently acquired at my shop. The one thing I love about Ed's Cards and Comics in Colorado Springs is he acquires a lot of old stuff. There, most of the other shops in Colorado Springs, they specialize in new comics, and their back issues are maybe four long boxes. Like that's not their business. Ed's is acquisition of old stuff and new stuff. And
I mean, that's a lot of comic shops now. Let's focus on the new stuff.
Focus on the new stuff. But the one thing I like about whoever, because he's the only shop in town to do that, nobody else is willing to buy those collections, and he gets some cool shit. I'm talking about like 40s and 50s and 60s. And he's really good to me as far as like he acquires them really low. Like he buys them really low. And but he sells them to me real at a really low markup, you know?
That's cool.
So he says, as long as you keep buying stuff, I'm gonna keep your markup low. So like that's where the doll mans are gonna come in place. I've been looking at them for quite some time. And there's one Plastic Man. I don't have any. I have a full run of Plastic Man, but the Silver Age Plastic Man. I don't have any Golden Age. And I want to have at least one. But let's talk World's Finest. So this is World's Finest that I just recently acquired. The cover is
Nice.
phenomenal. It's World's Finest Comics number 168. It's from 1967, August 1967, and contains a reprint from Detective Comics 176, which is the original Golden Age Robot Man. But what makes this comic special is I don't have a lot of comics that talk about composite Superman. I've read a lot of his modern day stuff, like in Superman, Batman, and stuff like that. But I haven't read a lot of the Silver Age composite Superman. And on this cover, it's got Batman punching Bruce Wayne. It's got Superman punching Clark Kent and Dick Grayson, Robin punching Dick Grayson. And it's awesome. This cover is like so striking. I believe there's no credits in this issue, but as I did some research, it looks like it's Kerry Bates that wrote the first story, which would explain why I loved it so much. Because Kerry Bates to me is the man. I mean, and then it had Kurt Swan art. But what's re really cool is it take it if it's very formulaic, comics from this age and the Bronze Age show you in the front page where you're going to be, and then it tells you how you got there and then it completes the story. It's kind of like the formula of a comic book back then. So at the beginning of it has composite Superman as Bouncing Boy, clobbering Batman, and as Elastic Lad wrapping himself around Superman. And it's the return of composite Superman. So now we go off to a prison cell on a far-off planet where there's this guy dying in his bed, and his name is Vile, Vyl, and he's like, I am dying and imprisoned here in my cell, and I'm gonna die because Superman and Batman imprisoned me here, and he basically says, can you call my son before I die? So his son shows up, and his son is Zan. This name is very important historically. Zan takes his father and says, I know you're dying, father, and I will seek revenge for you on Batman and Superman because you died in prison because of them. And I'm going to probably use this Magna gun to kill them. But I'm going to study. I'm going to do my research before I go and attack Superman. He basically does his research. He looks at all their villains, Lex Luthor, Joker, Brainiac, Penguin, Riddler. He's like, man, these guys have all been defeated. There is one villain that's never been defeated by Superman and Batman, and that's Composite Superman. So then the scene cuts to a museum, the Superman Museum, which there's this guy that's working there, and his name is Joe Mech, and he's essentially like the caretaker of the museum. Meech, sorry, his name is Joe Meech, and he basically was the composite Superman, but now he's the curate. He used to hate Superman, Batman, and now he is working in the museum. And he's like, you know, I don't know why I used to hate these guys. I really see how they could be treated as heroes. But this guy Zion blasts electric lightning flash near the Legion of Superheroes display, where Meech is working. And it strikes him and turns him into Composite Superman. And what's interesting about Composite Superman is he's half Superman, half Batman, but has all the powers of the Legion of Superheroes, which is really weird. He's got the ability to grow with Colossal Boy, the ability to shrink, Shrinking Violet, the ability to divide into three people, Triplicate Girl, the ability to fire lightning bolts, Lightning Lad, to generate heat, Sun Boy, the ability to be lightweight, Light Lass, the ability to be super heavy, Star Boy, the ability to consume anything, Matter Eater Lad, the ability to turn invisible, Invisible Kid, and then Bouncing Boy, Elastic Lad, we already talked about, the ability to shape shift. This is key, plays a big part in the story. Chameleon Boy, telepathy, Saturn Girl, Brainiac 5, he's got the intelligence, magnetic powers of Cosmic Boy. The superpowers and all the switching powers of Ultra Boy, which is unique. Element Lad, he can transmute elements like fire, Firestorm. How can you beat this fucker?
It's
The ability to face through
ridiculous.
matter, Phantom Girl. So he's pretty much every superhero you've ever
Pretty
heard
much.
of. How do you defeat him? But he becomes that, and then Zaya, he has this revenge thing with him. As soon as he turns to Composite Superman, all he wants is revenge, even though he was working at the museum. Well, the museum was attacked, so Clark Kent is on site in Metropolis and he sees the destruction and he's like, wow, I better call Bruce that someone's loose and they're destroying our museum, so they're probably after us. And at this time in Wayne Manor, Dick Grayson in there, and they have their aunt Harriet. It takes care of them, but they see this like light fixture go on inside of the Wayne Manor, which means somebody's in the Batcave. Well, Superman's in the Batcave, and he's saying, "Hey, Composite Superman's back, I believe," and he breaks right into the Batcave, and the first thing he does is there's Robin, Batman, and Superman. And you're like, well, we have the odds against him. We should be able to outnumber him. Well, what does he do? He uses Triplicate Girl's powers and makes three of them. starts beating the crap out of Superman, Batman. Batman gets it worse. One of the composite Supermans just like twirls him, like going 1,000 miles an hour just above his head. This would kill him probably. And he tosses Robin and then throws Superman through like the part of the cave. And then he uses his powers to phase Batman to increase his weight. He uses Sun Boy's powers. Batman becomes so heavy, he just starts sinking into the ground to hit the Earth's core. And Superman manages to save him, but he just like kicks their ass. And they originally catch his origin, and they see all the figures at the museum that were electrified, and they destroy those figures. So they're like, if we take these figures to Brainiac, he could tell us how he got his powers. So he has to charge by these Legion of Superheroes figures in the museum like every so often. And Brainiac says, yeah, the electricity must have, because what happened is they made these figures after actual Legion of Superheroes figures. They hit him with a ray, and it like cloned him and made a model of him. So when the lightning hit him, Composite Superman got all those powers. And one of the first things that Composite Superman does is he knocks out Robin and portrays himself as Robin, and Batman doesn't know. But he eventually catches on because I can't remember exactly why he caught on so easily. But it was there was like a clue, like Robin never does this kind of thing. And it looks like he's gonna hurt Batman pretty. He captures Batman and Robin, and he's probably gonna kill them. Meanwhile, Superman goes back to the museum and melts all those Legion of Superheroes figures. And then they get in a big old fist fight with Composite Superman, which is really cool because you could see him using all the Legion of Superheroes powers. Then they manage to defeat Composite Superman for a second. Zion comes back, and he says, "Good work, Meech," because Meech actually has Superman and Batman on their knees, and Robin's like sunk in the ground because of the gravity powers. And the Zion from the other planet is going to use his Magna Gun to kill him. And that's when Meech gets like this heroic thing. And for some reason, I guess because he worked in the museum and gained an appreciation for Superman and Batman, he's got a change of heart. So when he fires the gun at Superman and Batman to kill him, Meech jumps in front and Meech is dead. So they're basically at the memorial of Joe Meech, and it says he lived a criminal but died a hero. It's a fantastic issue. And if you look at the history of Composite Superman's, they ca you know how they captured Zion? He actually becomes Composite Superman.
Okay.
So Meech really did die.
Crazy.
But
Son of
God,
a Meech.
son of a Meech, it is awesome comic. It was so good. I had so much fun with this one.
Nice.
It really looked like if the story just if Z Zion never came back, Superman and Batman and Robin could have been dead. They would have been defeated at least. And then the Robot Man backup story was really interesting. This isn't the Robot Man from the Doom Patrol. This is a Golden Age Robot Man, which was basically the brain of a detective that was put inside the body of a robot.
All
And he's
right.
got all these abilities. And he wants to join this detective society. They're called the Clue Masters, and they basically, we're not going to accept you. What have you done? They're like the best detectives from around the world, French, British, American detectives. And they said, well, we're going to set up a test for you to see if you can be part of us. And they set up this really difficult test. And they essentially turn off, he allows them to turn him off for a little bit so he can't see how they're setting up the test, which is dangerous in itself. But he eventually solves he finds the artifact that they were hiding from him, and they allow him back into the society. So Robot Man becomes part of the Clue Masters. It was a really good Golden Age reprint, and I've never read ever anything with the Golden Age Robot Man.
Yeah.
Robot Man to me was the Doom Patrol. And then also he appeared in All Star Squadron, but he wasn't a
Oh,
detective.
yeah.
So this was a really good historical issue, fantastic issue. I loved it. I loved this issue.
That's cool. I like, yeah, it can be fun to pick up back when DC did a lot more reprints, and some of those can be a really nice package for reading, you know?
Yeah, both the reprint and the regular story, absolutely loved. Like, I was so into them.
Yeah, I mean, you pick up one of those, just like last episode, I talk about that DC Superstars of Space issue. You pick up that issue and you're reading for a while. Like, you get a lot of material in those larger size comics.
Yeah, I just read Spawn, and it took me almost 45 minutes to finish, maybe an hour.
Oh, really?
Spawn 250, it was really dense, because they used a lot of words to catch up. I guess they assumed a lot of people had lapsed and that they might be joining this because Al Simmons is coming back.
Oh, okay.
So I think they did a lot of work to try to get a new, person that has been a lapsed Spawn reader back up to speed
Yeah.
on what's been going on.
That would be me, because I haven't read Spawn since I was a kid.
Yeah.
But.
I think they did a pretty good job. I stopped reading Spawn when Al Simmons died. So the new guy, I read like two issues, and that's when I stopped. But I thought the issue did a really good job of catching me up to speed. But what else you got?
So it was going around for a while, that Four Comics thing on social media where people were putting their like four comics that got them into comics. And that was really cool. A lot of people were posting into their comics to the Taylor Network Facebook page, which was really fun. And I just really enjoyed it. Was fun that week looking at all those and just being reminded of all these different comics. And Ryan of the Star Joes podcast, one of his first comics reminded me was from the Danny Ketch Ghost Rider 1990s series. And I read maybe like the first like 12 or 15 issues of that when they were coming out. And I was just like, man, I want to read those again. So I was looking, there's only like the first six issues or something like that on Marvel Unlimited, but so I first, but I read the first three because it's like one complete storyline. But yeah, this was the second Ghost Rider, Johnny Blaze being the first one, and this is written by Howard Mackie, which this is like one of the first things that he wrote. You know, he went on to write a lot of Spider-Man stuff, and he wrote a lot of stuff that came out when I wasn't reading comics. But the art on this, I think when I was a kid, I didn't realize that it was just Mark Teixeira inking it. The pencils are actually by Javier Salteres. But I was a Teixeira fan when I was a kid, and I think I pretty much just focused on the fact that he was inking it, and it definitely looks like his heart. But yeah, this is a three-part story, Ghost Rider issue 1 through 3. And it's the first appearance of Danny Ketch and introduces him as the new Ghost Rider. The first issue is called Life's Blood, and it starts out with Danny and his sister Barbara, and it's Halloween, and they're going to visit Houdini's gravesite. And I got really interested in this, like, about whether, like, where is Houdini buried for real? And it looks like Mackie is pretty much basing, like, the cemetery in the story is fictional at Cypress Hills, it's called. But I got kind of interested in reading about this because it's actually Houdini's gravesite really is in New York City. It's in Glendale, Queens, in a cemetery called Machpelah. And apparently, like Houdini's gravesite, there's all these different committees over the years that have voluntarily taken up upkeep of it because the grave site itself was, or like the graveyard itself is really poorly kept. It's better now than it was, but I guess in like the 70s, it was so bad. Like there was no funding. It was so bad that like bodies were starting to appear like above the surface, and
How
it was
does
just
that
really.
happen? I thought that only happened in New Orleans.
I don't know.
Because
Maybe just over the
I thought in
years.
New Orleans it was because that's why they put them in the the above ground caskets and stuff because of just the ground, but I didn't think that was
Right.
New York.
Because of the like flood levels and stuff.
Yeah,
Yeah,
the
I don't.
flood levels. That's weird that you read that.
Yeah, it was strange, but apparently there's tons of cemeteries in Queens because they didn't have room in Manhattan or something back in the day, and I don't know, it was just really interesting. But anyways, so they're going to visit Houdini's gravesite, which apparently is a thing that people do in around Halloween or did. And they run into these like high school gang members called the Cypress Pool Jokers, and
And
they're
then you
just
hear the
all
music, insane in the membrane,
yeah.
insane in the brain.
Insane in the membrane. Insane in the
Brain.
brain. And my friends used to listen to that tape all the time. And they had that. There was that. They had like a bunch of songs in there. How I Could Just Kill a Man was another one.
I like the lyrics to that song.
Yeah. But anyways, so it's a situation of wrong place, wrong time kind of thing, because what's going on in the cemetery, besides all these kids there, is that there's two groups both going after the same thing. Kingpin has men there, and then there's this new character introduced for the first time called Death Watch, and Kingpin's men are taken out by Death Watch and his men, and they want to get these canisters. They don't really know what's in these three canisters, but there ends up being a fight between the two groups, and Danny and Barb are watching from the distance, and when Death Watch snaps the neck of a person, Barb yells out because she's freaked out, and that alerts them to their position, and Barb gets shot. So Danny takes her, and he's carrying her, and meanwhile, in the chaos, one of the members of the Jokers, a girl named Polly, she grabs the suitcase with the canisters and sneaks away. Death Watch's men are trying to track down all these kids that ran away from the scene, and they're going after Danny and Barbara, and they're hiding out in a nearby junkyard, and Danny has Barb's blood on his hand, and he touches the gas cap of this motorcycle that starts glowing, and when he does so, there's a real cool splash page where he becomes Ghost Rider and comes flying out of the junkyard on the motorcycle. So finish up the issue. The police arrive and they take Barb to the hospital. And they chase after Ghost Rider, but he eludes the police and then eventually turns back into Danny. He's like, "What the fuck just happened?" And then Death Watch and Kingpin both received the bad news from their men that neither of them came up with the suitcase and the canisters. So they both like bitch out their underlings and send them back out to look for the gang members. Issue two, do be afraid of the dark. Same creative team on all these, but this is kind of like a definitely a middle issue. Most of it is introducing a new character called Blackout that's working for Death Watch. And Blackout, it's mostly about Blackout tracking down the Jokers. He goes in to a detective's home and threatens the detective's family if he doesn't tell him where the Jokers are at. The detective tells him, and he kills the guy's family anyways, as well as the detective. And there's this one member of the Jokers that was hurt in the previous issue. So he's home from school, playing Nintendo, and Blackout shows up at his house and threatens him. And at this point, he's already killed the kid's parents, and they end up in the parents' room. It's like this real kind of dark scene because kid trips over his father's body and falls out the window. But he's caught by Ghost Rider, and then there's the rest of the issue is a fight between Ghost Rider. And definitely at this point, like, Blackout is surprised by the amount of power that Ghost Rider has, but because it's Danny, he's noticeably inexperienced at fighting. So a lot more happens in the final issue of the storyline called Death Watch. Death Watch, the character in Blackout, they attack the police office where they have Polly, and they're interviewing Polly. Ten police officers are killed and dozens more are injured as they abduct Polly and take her to the cemetery where the rest of the Jokers are, and the Jokers are freaking out at this point. They have two of the canisters, but Polly can't remember where she stashed the third one. So Blackout threatens the Jokers, is going to kill one by one until she tells them. And sure enough, he does snap the neck of one of the Jokers. We finally find out that what's in these canisters is a mutated biotoxin that Death Watch has been employed to release in the city and kill. It'll kill half the tri-state area immediately, and then the rest of the people will die agonizingly over time, and that's going to spread beyond the city. But at that point, Kingpin, he has sort of like a butler-looking guy that's his like number one. He's got glasses and he looks like a distinguished gentleman, but he shows up and he has all of them surrounded by men with guns. And Death Watch pretty much says, "All right, well, you got us surrounded. There's nothing I can do," and gives up pretty easily. But Blackout won't have it. He's the one that's holding on to Black onto the canisters. He's like, "Well, if Death Watch is not gonna take the canisters, then I will. I'll work for myself." And he just swipes his hand and cuts the Kingpin's man right across the throat. And he's able to collect the last of the three canisters, but Ghost Rider shows up at this point in time, and they have another fight where Blackout, he's kind of like a vampire-ish character. He bites into Ghost Rider's arm through the leather jacket and gets a nice mouthful of hellfire, which causes huge like disfiguration to his face, and he's like freaking out, like, "I'll get you! What did you do to me?" But the Hellfire, Ghost Rider's Hellfire, also fuses the canisters together and sterilizes the biotoxin inside of them, so it's pretty much neutralized. And the story ends with Barb, his sister, is still in a coma, but Danny is starting to, like, throughout the story, he's been pretty freaked out by the whole Ghost Rider thing. But at the end, he's sort of starting to consider, like, maybe there's some good to this. If there's innocent people that need to be protected, and maybe I can use this power for good. So yeah, I mean, it definitely held up for me. I story and art wise, I still enjoyed it. I like the, Ghost Rider character, and just like the darker areas of the Marvel Universe are fun to read about.
Yeah, that's when it spawned off all kinds of titles because it became so popular.
Yeah. It was
You had
definitely.
Spirits of Vengeance and the Night Stalkers and all kinds of titles coming up. Blade. Man, there was a lot of titles. And those were hot in the 90s. Like, if you looked at what was hot in Wizard Magazine, that was what was hot for Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't read a lot of that stuff. Like I said, I read this title for maybe a year and a half before I got out of comics for a while, but yeah, it held up. And you're right, this is probably one of the hottest times for Ghost Rider for sure. Lasted for a while. The series lasted for a while before, then it was kind of over the years since then, Ghost Rider's been kind of intermittent. They have some other series
Yeah, the
and they
series
wouldn't last
don't
as long.
last too long, you know. 12 issues and you're lucky. They had the
Yeah.
female Ghost Rider and he's been in other titles, but and the new one, the all new Ghost Rider, which I like, but it's gonna end soon.
Oh, is it okay? I was
But
wondering.
it's not a Catch or a Johnny Blaze, it's a new one.
Right.
And but Johnny Blaze is still around in the universe. It's not like he replaced him.
Right.
So,
Yeah, I read something about he even shows up in that series or something where he goes to talk to the new Ghost Rider or something. I don't know. I haven't read any of that yet, but yeah, I dug these. I like them. They're pretty easy, even if you. They're pretty easy to come by, just because, like you said, it was really popular in the print runs on at least early on, and the series were pretty high, it looks like. So they're not too hard to acquire. So I might, because I'd like to read some more of the ones that I read and that aren't on Marvel Unlimited. So I might pick them up just to read
Yeah,
them.
you could find a lot. There were so many of them made that you could find them in dollar bins, or you
Yeah.
just have to look. So my last issue, with no surprise, is Armed and Dangerous Special, by Bob Hall. This one, we got to know a character that it focuses on one character called Candy Kane. She's a stripper, and she has interesting origins in the fact that she didn't have big boobs, and then she had to buy them to stay in the business. But she was introduced in an earlier issue of Armed and Dangerous that I didn't talk about, where Doogie went to the strip club and had sex with Candy Kane. 'Cause he used to Candy Kane. I always think that Joyride. Did you see that movie, Joyride? It's
Isn't that
about a trucker that they fuck with, two guys on a CB fuck with, and it has the guy that was in Paul. What's his name? The guy who just died. He was in all those movies about cars. Can't even think of the name. God damn it. Paul Walker. Yeah,
Oh, right,
Paul
yeah.
Walker's in the
Fast
movie.
and Furious, yeah.
Yeah, he's in the Fast and Furious movies, but he yeah, Steve Zahn is the other actor. Thank you, Barb.
I hear in the background here.
She's the TV and movie expert in this household. I'll talk comics and she'll get me straight on the TVs and movies. But
Just like Penny Two in the background there.
yeah, Penny too, can you help me? I'm in the Batmobile driving.
Yeah.
I need a clue. Sounds like no. But they fuck with the trucker and they basically call them. One of them uses a girl voice, Steve Zahn, and he says, "Can you meet me at a hotel?" And they actually meet. He goes to meet him, but they fuck with him, and he turns out to be like a killer, and he stalks them the whole issue. But that's not anything to do with this comic, other than the name of the prostitute is Candy Kane. And she's an interesting character. It goes through her backstory. She started stripping in the 80s and didn't do really. She did some prostitution, but then she got raped, and then stopped doing the prostitution stuff, and then just started stripping. And she needed to buy boobs, so she got in with Arko, who's the bad villain of the Frank Arko is the the one guy that wasn't killed during that mafia assassination, which we think he might have killed Eddie's father, but he basically says, "Yeah, I'll pay for your boobs if you do X." And then she ends up having to hide from him, but she runs into Lana, and at this point, Lana is missing a tooth. You know, we're talking about a 15, 16-year-old girl. She's been beaten by her pimp pretty bad. But Eddie beat the shit out of her pimp one time because the pimp beat him up because he was with Lana, and the pimp was very protective of Lana, and he was going to kill Lana one time. And Eddie, who's the main character of the book, the one that's learning to be a cleaner, got a bat, and he just beat the shit out of that pimp. He was just like, boom, knock out his knees, and he was gonna kill him, but then Lana, who's the prostitute, was, "How am I gonna get my drugs? Don't, please don't kill him, Eddie. You know, I need my drugs." So he let him live, but he's like in one of those automatic wheelchairs. He can stand, but he can't really walk effectively. And this one, they're actually going after Lana, and the stripper. Candy Cane is protecting her the whole episode, and she's trying to give her a new life, and that's what this whole issue is about. It's about them escaping this area of New York and going to Texas, and she saved Lana's life and got her off of drugs, and they got away from the pimp and this other guy that was trying to kill, to do weird sexual things to Lana that she wouldn't even do, even for drugs. So it must have been really bad. It doesn't say what it was. But yeah, it was a really good issue. It built up. The one thing about this comic, Armed and Dangerous, is there's like five, six characters, and it just keeps building on these characters, and you learn a lot about these characters, which I really love.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool. That's like I said before, never heard of. I definitely dig noir crime comics and stuff, and I never heard of these.
Yeah,
So.
I really enjoyed it, and I have four more issues to read at some point, which I may cover on the show, or I might just put on Facebook. I don't know. Just depends on when I read them, I guess.
Right, yeah. But very dark, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's very dark. The characters are really good, and there's still so much open story, so I'm hoping that the next four, well, we at least know that. And in conclusion, we at least know that Lana and Candy Cane are out of the picture for the most part. They've escaped to Texas, and I don't think that the pimp is going to go after them because they did really good job of covering their tracks.
Gotcha.
But who knows? They could come back in it. And Doogie is a mess. Oh, there was one scene in the original one that I forgot to mention. Is remember I mentioned that roller girl? Well, she was an assassin, and she shot this one dude through, like, clipped him in the head and thought he was dead, but he wasn't. And they send Mitch, the cleaner, to go clean up the situation. Well, he gets there, and the dude's still alive. She didn't kill him.
Oh,
So
jeez.
they get in a gunfight, and Mitch is shot like near the chest, like near his heart. And during this time, they have to take him, Eddie and Doogie have to take him to like one of those underground doctors, you know, that will fix mafia people. And they have to get him patched up, but it's a pretty weird scene because then Eddie and Doogie have to start doing stuff, and they're just kids. I mean, Eddie's really young. They're cousins, but Doogie is more like, I think, in his 20s and a taxi cab driver. And he starts doing stupid shit like pocketing money. Like if he goes to do a collection, you know, for somebody, he'll say, he'll keep, "Oh, here's one for me, one for my boss, here's two for me." He starts doing that shit.
Yeah.
Some fingers, so who knows what's going to happen to him.
That's never a
But
good idea.
yeah, it's not a good idea when messing with these people. But yeah, it's a good series. I'm so glad I picked it up.
Yeah, it's cool. Well, I'll just talk briefly about the last one that I have. I won't go through it in super detail, but there was DC did like about around 2002 or so, they did a bunch of one shots called DC First. There was Superman, Lobo, Green Lantern, like Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, Alan Scott, and Batman, Joker, and then I picked this one up, Superman and the Flash, because like to go, it sort of goes with the Geoff Johns period of on the Flash, and I didn't have this, I hadn't read this, and it's written by Geoff Johns, the art is by Rick Bruchette. But it has a Kevin Nolan cover of the gimmick on these was there was always something that was like the first time of something, and or it like harkened back to the first time of something, and this was the gimmick on this one was the first race between Superman and the Jay Garrick Flash.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about this? Not to interrupt you,
No, it's
but I own this, but not in a comic form, but which is interesting. I own it in one of those mini comics, if I
Oh,
remember
okay.
correctly. I got it in one like a DVD set or something.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, so this, I mean, it's a fun story. It's a oversized issue. It's an abracadabra story. But if you know, one of the things I found interesting about it was
I want to reach out and grab you.
So right at the beginning, it tells you that it takes place between Impulse issue 84 and the Flash issue 184. And if you know anything about the Flash series around that time, I guess, maybe I won't spoil it, but I'll just allude to what's going on for people that already that read that. There's a storyline involving Zoom, a new Reverse Flash. That happened like 19, or it was like issue 198, 99, 200 or something, and so with mentioning that this takes place around issue 184 is kind of coming up on that storyline. Well, that's all I'll say, but it opens up with Hunter Solomon. Who is works for the Keystone City Police, and he's a profiler. He's interviewing Pied Piper at Iron Heights Penitentiary, and Pied Piper is talking about how the Flash has told me that to look into your case. He said you were actually framed for the murder of your parents. But Pied Piper ends up actually attacking him and knocking him on the floor. But then the police, or the police, the guards come in and knock out Pied Piper. But we see that Pied Piper, he managed in the scuffle to grab what looks like a piece of the table leg. He's got like a little piece of wood in his hand as they're leading him away, and Hunter says, take me down to the pipeline. I gotta meet with amnesia victim number two. Supposedly his mind's been wiped, but I need to verify that. So they take him down, and he, you see that he's going in to talk to Abracadabra. And Abracadabra at this point is doesn't look like himself at all. He's locked up in a straitjacket and his head shaved, and he seems like he's crazy, but and Hunter asks the guard, why is he not secured? And The guard says, "Well, we stripped him of every techno gadget, because the whole thing with Abracadabra is he gives the appearance of doing magic, but he's actually an expert of technology, and it's his technology from this, I think it's 65th century, and it's just such advanced technology that it looks like magic." Well, turns out that they hadn't done proper stripping him of his powers, of his technology, because he says, "Door, abracadabra, choom!" The door goes flying off at the guard and hunter, and he says, "Skin, abracadabra," and his scarred skin and his hair and everything like that all comes back, and he breaks out of jail. So, and it's kind of funny because he's doing tricks on the guards, and other rogues are like the top are clapping and applauding him. And that's Abracadabra's thing. But the interesting thing that I was talking about earlier is he is about to attack Hunter, and he says, "I see it now. I'm not going to perform a trick on you, friend. There's something else, your future. I'll be rooting for you." And then he disappears. So if you know what ends up happening later on with Hunter, it's kind of interesting that Johns was foreshadowing it like a year earlier, or
Hunter
so here.
Zolomon,
Yeah. So then we get into Wally.
which is really weird because he's in the TV show too, right?
So yeah, so we see Jay Garrick and Wally West. They're the two Flashes. They're going to a bookstore where, at this point, Jay Garrick's wife is battling cancer, and he's going to buy her a book, like a first edition of a book that was one of her favorites when she was a kid and stuff. And at that point, Abracadabra attacks, and they're actually in a metropolis. That's where Superman comes into the story. Is that this bookstore is in Metropolis that they're going to pick this up? So, Superman comes in to help because he hears it with his super hearing that there's something strange going on, and the setup of the story and what the reason that there's not it's not really a race, but that Superman and Jay Garrick end up running is that Abracadabra, he calls it a curse, but like with everything that he does, there's actually a technology behind it. But Wally West is aged, and becomes super old, and he's going to be dead of old age in less than 5 minutes. And then he says, "Run, Abracadabra," and Wally starts running super fast in place. And all of a sudden, it's Abracadabra's Great Race, and Superman, Wally, and Jay are all at the starting line, and he tells them, Superman and Flash, Jay Garrick, they have to outrun the fastest man alive, Wally West, because at this point, Wally's, the fastest. He's faster. His speed is faster than Jay or Superman, and so they basically have to catch him. And the first one of them who touches Wally will absorb this supposed curse on him, and become afflicted themselves. So they start running, and while they're running, Superman and Jay are fighting over who's going to be the one to touch Wally, and they're like, Wally must be under Abracadabra's control because he'd be so far ahead of us that we'd never have any chance. So Abracadabra is actually like, maintaining Wally's speed at a certain, so it's possible for them to catch him. And so they're fighting over it the whole time. He's Abracadabra wants to actually entertain by the race between Jay, and Jay's like, I'm the older one, like I can do it. And Superman keeps saying, "No, I'm not human, so I have a better chance of surviving it." But Jay eventually pulls a trick on Superman that something that Wally has been teaching him to do. He steals his speed. But when he does that, it's actually been something that Abracadabra has been waiting for him to do. And he does something to extend the lightning field around Jay. And there's this really weird page where you actually see them running through time. So they run past, we see Professor Zoom. We see them actually run past Cosmic Boy, and they end up actually in the 64th century. So this is like Abracadabra's plot all along. So at this point, Jay touches Wally before Superman can stop him. He says, "Tell Joan I love her," and automatically Wally is back to his normal age, and Jay is about to die. He's going into cardiac arrest, and but this actually created an opportunity for with Superman's microscopic vision. He was able to see what the technology behind it was, that it was actually nanotechnology, and that there were there's he saw these nanites jumping from Wally to Jay. They're microscopic robots burrowing into his skin, attacking his cells. So what Wally does is he uses his speed to trigger Jay's power, and he vibrates Jay fast enough that the nanites can't keep up with him, and that makes them vulnerable to a blast of Superman's heat vision. Abracadabra did all this so that he could ride their time traveling back or forward with them, so that he could get back to his future and raid a weapons division and get a new, basically replenish his supply of technology. He's confronted at this point. The both the Flashes are healthy, and he's confronted by the three heroes. And it's a kind of a neat callback that Geoff Johns does here, because Abracadabra starts attacking them, and he turns Superman into a puppet. And that's one of the things that Abracadabra did back in the Silver Age. There's like a famous cover of Barry Allen Flash as a puppet Flash. So he that's a callback to that, and he turns Jake Garrick into a turtle. Well, basically, he steals this technology. It's this like fourth dimensional chaos sphere, and he wants to use it to absorb the life force of everybody around. Wally grabs Jay's helmet off a turtle Flash, and he uses Jay's helmet to speed around and deflect all the rays that are shooting off of the off of this fourth dimensional chaos sphere. He said, and Wally's like, there were over 500 beams coming out of this chaos crystal. Reflecting 1,000 might have been difficult, but 500, that's just a jog for me, magician. And this is pretty much where the heroes get the upper hand, and Jay and Wally combine their kinetic energy and speed and rip into the time stream. Then they're able to return to their proper timeline. And in the epilogue, they actually have Abracadabra trapped in the chaos sphere, and they put him behind bars in Keystone. And it ends on a nice note between Jay and Wally, where Wally thanks him for risking his life to save him, and Jay points out Superman was willing too. That's just the beauty of who we work with in the Justice Society and the Justice League. Any one of us would risk our lives for another. That's what real friends do. But then the second part of the epilogue is a foreshadowing of upcoming storyline in Flash comic, where we go back to Pied Piper and we see that table leg that he grabbed, he's been using it to carve out a little pipe, and he starts playing it. And the last page of the story is a splash page of Pied Piper saying it's good to have friends, and he's just surrounded by rats. His entire cell is filled with rats, and he's got rats on his shoulders and stuff. So it's doing the reveal that the Pied Piper is relapsing into his criminal ways. So it's neat how it was kind of like a done in one, but it also ties into if you're reading the Flash at the time. And I've been reading so much Silver Age Flash lately, and doing like a Wally West podcast. The Kid Flash appearances, it was kind of fun to jump way forward in the character's life when he was at his prime as the Flash and really had it down as far as being the Flash, and what had kind of surpassed Barry in terms of his understanding of his powers and stuff. So that was a fun read. So that's it for me.
Alrighty. I think I read that title. So it sounds familiar, but I think I read it in that little mini comic. And
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know what DVD it came in.
yeah, it sounds familiar that I remember seeing that it came with something when I
Yeah.
was searching for this to pick it up, because I was just kind of,
I think it was one of those animated movies or something.
yeah. I mean, once I completed my run of the Wally West Flash volume, I was just kind of, I had in the process like picked up a bunch of other stuff that I knew were like one shots and stuff, and I was kind of going through to see if there's anything I was missing, and I came across this, so I ordered it.
Yeah.
And I had been meaning to read it for a while now, so finally got around to
Cool deal.
it.
Well, you can reach us at our website at geekbrunchpodcast.com, and our Facebook page is Geek Brunch Podcast, and we have all the episode threads there. And at MythMakingETC on Twitter, and he's also posts his MythMakingETC on our Geek Brunch website that he's, that Chris has been talking about. He's doing the Flash retrospectives. He also did a recent episode on the new DC releases.
Yeah,
So check that out if you're interested in what those new DC releases are.
thanks.
And what else we got? I'm at Mike Myers Brunch, and email is mike@comicbooknoise.com and at mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And that should wrap us up until next week when we come back with Buck Rogers, and who knows what we'll be covering in comics.
We don't even know
We don't
ourselves.
know. I usually don't know until Friday night.
Yeah, usually like if not Friday, like a couple days before that is me too.
Yeah. All
So.
right. Well, have a good one, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, yeah, have a good week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Come and dance on our floor.
Come and dance on our floor.
Take a step that is new.
Take a step that is new.
People of every space that needs your face, please come for me too. You'll see that love is a fun again. Love is coming.